Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, January 21st, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you are listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389#. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading, excuse me, it's going to be in the Gospel of John. We're going to pick up where we left off. We're moving into chapter 11. Now, I was looking through chapter 11. You know, I usually try to read maybe 15, 20 verses and then pick it up the following week. But sometimes you got a story going that it's just not wise to break it up. So this is going to be quite long tonight. It's going to go through half the chapter. It's a pretty long chapter, but we're going to do about half. It's going to be verses 1 through 46. So John chapter 11, verses 1 through 46. Now a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sisters sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Now Jesus loved Martha, and her sister, and Lazarus. When he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. Then after that saith he to his disciples, Let us go into Judea again. His disciples say unto him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in a day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. These things said he, and after that he saith unto them, Our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I might awake him out of sleep. Then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. Howbeit Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking rest in sleep. Then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I am not or was not there, to the intent ye may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. Then said Thomas, which called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, Let us also go, that we may die with him. Now Bethany was to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she had heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary sat still in the house. Then said Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if thou of God, God will give it thee. Jesus saith unto her, Thy brother shall rise again. Martha saith unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus saith unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this? She saith unto him, Yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. And when she had so said, she went her way and called Mary her sister secretly, saying, The Master is come and calleth for thee. As soon as she had heard that she rose quickly and came unto him. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Jews then, which were with her in the house, and comforted her, when they had saw Mary, that she had rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, She goeth unto the grave to weep there. Then when Mary was come where Jesus was, and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in his spirit, and was troubled, and said, Where have ye laid him? They said unto him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. Then said the Jews, Behold how he loved him. And some of them said, Could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have cause that even this man should not have died? Jesus therefore again, groaning in himself, cometh to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, Take ye away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days. Jesus saith unto her, Said I not unto thee, that if thou would believe, that thou shouldest see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me, and I knew that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. And when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. And many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen this thing which Jesus did, believed on him. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. Okay, we'll pick up in verse 47 next Monday. That was the Gospel of John, chapter 11. We read from verses 1 through 46. Okay. Okay, we don't have a particular topic, so we might move right over into Brent, if Brent is here, pretty quickly, and or into open forum. I don't see Brent in yet. Do you, Jan?
No, I haven't seen him yet.
Okay, well, let's go forward, and we'll see what happens in the next few minutes. Do we have any announcements or any questions? But before we go to that, I just want to make a note. I was watching a few videos today. I usually try to watch some of the videos in the news, different individuals like X22 and so on. And X22 is pretty good. I think there was one that came out about an hour and a half, 2 hours ago I just listened to. But David Zebulik, I don't know how many people listen to his channel. Every once in a while he pops up on my list, and I usually listen in. And tonight he had a really, really good program. So if anybody hasn't heard David's program, David Zublick, Zublick channel, is dated for today, the 21st, and getting a lot of feedback from you, Jen. Maybe your mic is too loud, lower it or something. It's over-modulating. Anyway, so David Zebulik, he's really covering a lot of stuff. He's claiming that that he is one of the channels, and there's a few others out there, and I don't know who they may be yet because I haven't seen them yet. But I've been given reports concerning what's happening with the trials and what's going on across the United States as far as arrests are going on and so on. And he reported that put out quite a few names, and they're all big names. It's the only ones he had given. I think it was 74,000, if I remember, or 47,000. I think it was 74,000 indictments many of which will be tried, so quite a few of them will be tried military. And he claims that the military tribunals are happening as we speak and have been going on for quite some time. I did hear that back a few weeks ago from other sources. And he named a lot of big names that he's been given information concerning indictments. And, you know, it's all the big names that we've been looking at, seeing the Bushes, the Clintons, the Obamas, just to begin with. All of the individual players of the deep state we've been watching over the past year and a half or so going through their exercise before Congress, all of those people were named. And quite a few people that I was kind of surprised. There were two names in there I was surprised about. I'm not going to bring them up. People should go out and go and listen and see once for themselves what they think. So David Zubelik channel on YouTube, Zublick, for those who don't know him. Watch the one dated for today, the 21st. He usually has good stuff, and he covers a lot of the problems with, the pedophilia, slave trafficking of all ages, but particularly of children. And he's been doing that for quite some time. I'm surprised the guy's still alive with all the information he's been putting out on that particular subject matter. But in any event, he claims to be getting first-hand information directly from and through the people connected. I'm not sure exactly who, but somebody connected through the military in the White House. And again, he claims that he has been chosen as one of the media outlets that will be covering over the course of the next year, potentially up to 2 years, of trials and different things. He also says that the news media are very much aware of what's happening out there, and they sent some boats, I believe they just arrived, that's what it sounded like he was saying, some prison boats, I think two of them, pretty large boats that went out to Guantanamo and are there for the purpose of being able to house a large intake of prisoners. So I have no reason to doubt this information. This guy's been pretty good. I've been listening to him for quite some time now also, and I think he's been pretty accurate in his reportings, and I don't see him as someone that would make things up. So I do believe him. But anyway, people should check him out and see once what they think and make your own decision on what you think. Eventually, all of this will break out into the news. I can kind of understand why they're doing it this way, because if they just went out and did things, imagine what the fake media would be doing. Saying it's a coup and this and that, and on and on and on, even though they know, okay, no one's talking. But it will get out into the regular media eventually, and we'll see where it goes from there. Okay, that's the only thing I got. I don't have a particular subject matter. I did work. Jan, did you get... the latest, I think it was Chapter 7B.
7A and 7B. Yeah, I sent them back to you. They're in your Skype pin.
Okay, I'll download them tonight or tomorrow morning and start working on them. I'm going to be adding to 7A, and I'm not sure whether to name these things Chapter 7A, 7B, or maybe I should name them Chapter 7-1 or 7-2, or maybe just Chapter 7, 8, 9. What do you think on that? It's going to be covering the introduction to the founding documents, then the which you already got, and then it's going to the next is the Declaration of Independence. We're going to take that one first, which you've got, and sent back. After that...
I think they need to be all under the same chapter, because they all tie together, you know?
It's just going to be a large chapter, because it's going to be some of the large stuff. We're going to then move into the Constitution, which I'm going to approach very differently than anyone else who studied the Constitution. I'm going to look at this as construction of law, and we'll look at the Senate first, or the House of Representatives first, one of the two houses, because their Article 1, we'll pick it up there. And then we'll get into each of the powers of government. We'll get into the administrative and, of course, the judiciary. And so we're going to get into the construction of law. And construction of law, where you build up knowledge collectively, bringing together, you know, different sections of law to construct a meaning and a conclusion. And that's what construction of law ultimately is. As a matter of fact, let me see if I have this open. I might have the actual, here's the actual, I think this came out of, well, I know it came out of Black's Law, construction of law, or construction, the process or the art of determining the sense, real meaning, or proper explanation of obscure or ambiguous terms or provisions in a statute, written instrument, or oral agreement, or the application of such subject to the case in question by reasoning in the light derived from extenuous connected circumstances, or laws or writings bearing upon the same or a connected matter, or by seeking and applying the probable aim and purpose of the provision. And then, of course, there's a U.S. Court case that gave that particular meaning, and Black's Law adopted the meaning of that word construction for construction of law. And so that's kind of it. I have not seen anyone take that kind of an approach looking at the Constitution. I did start looking at the Constitution in a point by point, beginning with Article 1, line by line, going to the next line, and so on and so forth, and talking about it. But if we extract from the Constitution anywhere and everything that gives the authority to the Senate, for instance, then we can get a nice big picture of the power and the authority of the Senate, what exactly they can bring up and what they can't bring up as far as the discussion within the Senate. The House of Representatives, that's where laws arise. The Senate has to approve those laws, so they have to vote also. But laws all start in the House. I think money, anything with money and budget, starts in the House. The choosing of appointed individuals or Supreme Court judges, that's in the Senate. And the House will go through an approval. Well, actually, the Senate makes the approval, and that's it, period. And this is very important to understand why our founding fathers put this together that way. We will be discussing those issues in this particular study on that particular chapter. But one of the key things and points about the Senate that we need to understand is the Senate is the representatives of the state. And that is why it's so important to get rid of the repugnant 17th Amendment, because it took away the power and the authority from the state. It removes their sovereignty. They have no power or authority to be able to make any claim. They are subject 100% totally to the federal government, and they have no power. They're powerless to argue against and deny and vote against. They've lost their vote. And that's what happened. That's what the 17th Amendment did. And in return, it not only removed the power and the authority of the state, and they are no longer sovereign states, where even the Declaration of Independence demands that the states be a sovereign state. The Bill of Rights demands it in Article Amendment 10. Okay. And, of course, the Constitution declares it in numerous places, and we're going to bring that up and show that when we look at the Senate, to see the powers and the authorities of the Senate, so that we really – and it's limited. Anything beyond what we're going to see as we study these different, powers, branches, anything that's not there, well, they don't have the power to do. So then you can – once we, the people, need to understand this. Once we, the people, do understand this, then we can keep an eye on them and say, wait a second, foul, you can't make laws in that area. You can't do that. You can't do this. You don't have the power and the authority. We don't say that because we're ignorant. We don't say that because we don't know it. And so we need to know it, and we need other people to know it. And so that's what this course that we have out there, that if you're not taking it, you should definitely get into, Government by Consent course. Find that on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, the blue bar, free courses. Come down under the free courses. You'll find government by consent. Click on that. We do ask for a donation of $5 a month or more with a commitment for 2 years at $60 a year for taking that course. And the book will hopefully follow pretty quickly after that. We may have a publisher. Won't know until I get the book done. The book will be done by the time the course is completely, you know, put up there. The book should follow not long after that because they're pretty closely the same. The book will be available for purchase. And then I think what we're going to try to do is try to get something going with, trying to get people to commit in every county across America to purchase one book and to get that copy of that book to their sheriff. There's something about the power of written word in a book. It all of a sudden becomes real. It all of a sudden becomes accepted. So that's what we're going to try to do. We're still going to be working on the sheriff's project, which is moving slowly, but again, we need donations for that too, to get sheriff's handbooks into the pockets of every one of our sheriffs and deputies. But anyway, back to the course. Once we go through the course, you will understand the power and the authority of the Senate and how far they can go. The same thing with the House of Representatives, their powers and authority and how far they can go in lawmaking. We also will understand the judiciary powers and authorities and what the law is and how far they can go. What's the difference between a court of record, which is also called a court of law, and equity, which we did discuss earlier in it, but we'll get some more into that as we go forward. So the approach is going to be a little different than any other that I've seen. Again, most people who give a study on the Constitution or any of these things, the Constitution particularly, they go point by point. You know, Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1, Clause 2, Clause 3, Section 2, so on and all the way through. We're going to be, and again, I believe this will be, you know, a much more enlightening approach to the Constitution. Eventually we will develop the political side of our website, which is the political process without the politics. We're not going to get into politics. We're going to encourage everyone to stay away from it. Once there's that politics that they get involved with, once they're involved with that, then they're doing things outside of their powers and authority. Jefferson was totally frustrated and disgusted with it. George Washington was so disgusted with it that two-thirds to three-quarters of his farewell speech was concerning the problem with parties and the solutions. But we didn't listen. We need to go back and review what our founding fathers have told us and be much more obedient to, because they're much wiser than us. And of course, you know, our Constitution is being destroyed. You know, we the people, we have been enslaved through the tax system, through the IRS, through the Federal Reserve. And they've opened up their debtors' prisons. You know, they come out after you for taxes, they'll put you in jail. Now that means we too are subjects to the federal government. You know, how often do we go into the courts declaring our unalienable rights and they ignore us? They just ignore them. Why? Because begin with the 16th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, which says we no longer have rights, but we have privileges given to us by the federal government, by the way. We have the Organic Act of 1871. This is all construction of law. And when you see how we're going to approach the Constitution as in construction of law, constructing the point by point, the powers and the authorities as we move through, you'll understand how law works. The law that we don't need to know about, the law that doesn't affect us, and that's, for instance, on the federal level, that's U.S. titles 1 through, 57 or something, I think, titles. And they don't affect us. They have no power or authority over us. They all have their own jurisdictions. And unless you're participating in some kind of a commercial activity that might be attached to that, which we've given them the authority to make law for, or you become elected or an appointed individual within the government, or you're just employed. Now you fall under certain controls and guidelines and rules and regulations, they're called, just like any other corporation. The government had to have rules and regulations and the powers, the authorities, the process, the procedures of the people working in the government, whether they're elected, appointed, or just employed directly. And so we'll understand those things, and we don't need to study those. We just need to understand the borderline understanding of them and where their powers and authorities are. Half of those 57 titles, I know we spoke about this before, but half of those U.S. titles are what's called positive law. Okay, pretty interesting name they give it, positive law. It's positive, all right. But positive law, which means law created by human. That's exactly what it means, positive law, law created by human. Or what other laws are there? Well, there's laws created by God. It's called natural law, common law, the law we, the people, are under, and the only law we are under. We are free from all positive law. We are free from any and all control by the government. We, the people, ordained and established this Constitution for the United States of America. We are the declarers. We're the one that ordained it. We are above the Constitution. We ordained it for them, and we didn't give them any power or any authority to write a penal code and to apply it upon the people. We've given no power, no authority to write any kind of a title of law that could to control our behavior. And that goes right down to the state, to the counties, to the towns, to the cities, and so on. All those courts, any court that operates under statutory process is called an equity court. And it may be an administrative equity court. It could be a lawful equity court where American jurisprudence is applied, and they must follow guidelines of American jurisprudence, which ultimately is made up mostly of United States Supreme Court decisions. But a lot of, other things, for instance, principles laid out in common law that have been around for thousands of years. For every injury, there must be a remedy, that kind of thing. In order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party. And just because it's an injured party doesn't mean it's a crime. But it's an assault or an offense or it could be an accident or whatever. But if you are held liable, you have to, restore that individual. You know, and again, we've spoken about this. Jail, for instance, is not usually an option. Jail doesn't make sense. It doesn't do anything for anyone. I mean, if they're violent killers, of course, you can put them in jail. But, generally speaking, if they're violent killers, you end up killing them. You bring them to the death penalty. Let the people decide. But generally speaking, our jails are filled with people that shouldn't even be in there. They should be restoring the individual that they accidentally or purposefully injured, and in that process, not only is the individual restored, but so is the soul of the individual who injured the other in a repentive way. More often than not, that could become a very positive thing, change the person's mind and heart possibly, and bring them back into society for them to be hopefully, people who will give back instead of people who take. So our old justice system is turned upside down on its head. We need to fix it. The only way we're going to fix it is through knowledge. And again, that's what this course is all about. It's all about getting the knowledge, the necessary knowledge that every individual that is an American should have. And also our civics course between the two, which covers history and some common law and different things there also, and also explains on how we got to where we're at. If you want to know how we got to where we're at and how the deep state got their power and the authority that they've got, how they took over this nation, how they've crept in, going all the way back to 1776, the plan was already in effect. As that Declaration of Independence was being signed and sealed by our founding fathers, their plan was already executed, and they also organized and dated the very same dates And that's why you'll see the 1776, July 4th, in places, really that is controlled by the Illuminati or the elite, the powers that be, whatever you want to call them. So, but anyway, hopefully this course, well, you know, the hardest part of this course is being written right now. Probably going to take a couple of weeks to get this hard part, maybe not even that long. It depends on how much time I have to really to put into it. But it could be done in a week, and then we'll be working on the other final chapters, which, again, we have a lot of the material, you know, already collected, ready. You just got to put it into, you know, a form of being able to articulate it and put it in some kind of an order and tie it all together in order to bring this whole thing together. Court access. There's a list for anybody who wants to know the list. The list is going to change and alter a little bit, but I, you know, not sure exactly, you know, maybe renumber some chapters, reorganize its place that we've got. But we did put together a list. You can go up to nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight free courses, come down, hit on government by consent course, and it tells you to read this page if you're going to, before you click or join anything, so that you know how this course is put together. And on the bottom, we have a table of contents, chapter 1, and we bring it all the way up till chapter 15. Not sure how many chapters we're going to end up with, but that's sort of our preliminary list that we put together. And again, it's going to be changed around a little bit, and we'll see how that comes up. But again, this will be a very informative study that every American needs. And I want to tell you, you know, I've been looking at these things for over 20 years now. My sojourn, so to speak, started in about 1999, 2000, with We the People with Robert Schultz, which led that group, and he was the founder of We the People. And he took us right into the Continental Congress. Many people don't know that there was the Third Continental Congress that met, I think it was 2008, if I recall. We do have a copy of their work, and we also have on our line, and we also have a recording of a lot of the debates and discussions prior, leading up to the Continental Congress. There was conferences that were held out in Washington. Matter of fact, what is it? Goodness, I'm trying to remember. What's the TV station, Jan? Do you remember that covers Congress? What is that called? Do you remember?
No, I'm afraid I don't watch it.
Well, it could be interesting. I know I've watched it a few times. Some of the things were interesting. And they do cover some good speeches and stuff. But I just can't think of the name of it. In any event, you know, We the People's conference was covered by that.
C-SPAN.
Thank you very much. C-SPAN 1 and C-SPAN 2, I think there is, right? But they covered the works of the of Robert Schultz with We the People. They had a conference that came together. And then they did two of them, and it was covered by C-SPAN. The Continental Congress, they didn't do in Washington. I forget where they did that. But they did do an election across the nation. People went out to be represented as a delegate for the Continental Congress, and they came out with conclusions. I know we spoke about that in the past. It was a very, very well done. Unfortunately, the government just doesn't care. They ignored us. But anyway, you know, I go back. That's when I started, back in about 2000, 2001. And I want to tell you, I've read a lot of stuff. I've looked at a lot of stuff, been to a lot of websites, did the man on the land stuff, understood the, you know, standing, and I got to make my declaration, follow with the county, and be careful how I'm going to deal with my Social Security, and what about not being a citizen, and I got my driver's license, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. It's all a bunch of BS. Not that it's not true. All of it is true. It's all construction of law. But the final pieces have not really been put in place. Some of it has most recently, you know, with the Patriot Act and things of that nature. You know, it's all part of the puzzle, construction of law, that they're building up. And they have a lot of things already in there that doesn't even make sense because it's waiting for other pieces to fill that spot to get that whole puzzle together. And I'm sure it's already written. Everything is already written and laid out. It's all out there. But I'm sure there's still a few more installments they need to put in there. But when you go back and you go through all this stuff and you see the construction of law, which is constructing a statutory prison for we the people, it is all true. It is all part of the process. It is a problem. It's how they look at you. They interpret you as a citizen and therefore one of the subjects of them is subject to them. And, you know, and that you have to pay your big-time taxes and you have to have a driver's license and all this stuff. Even though a lot of these things are kind of in effect, they're not full force, but they are part of the plan of imprisonment. It's part of the construction of law. A lot of this stuff is just so off the wall and so difficult to piece together. And, you know, I was looking at some titles today. I was looking at Title 28, trying to find some stuff. I know I kept some notes of it, and looking back for it, and I'm going through 28 recently. There's 28A and 28B USC. But I was going through that, and it references, oh, something about this, and then you go over to another number, and it references something else. And it just gives you lots of numbers and paragraphs affected by this, changed by that. And then you go over there, and this was affected by this and changed by that, and you move over there. And you're going back and forth. It makes you dizzy. And if you trace down, though, and trace down those steps and find out how they construct it and how they attach these things and the meaning of stuff and they hit it, you'll find at the end of the trail, you'll find something, and that wouldn't make sense without you tracing it down, knowing that it's attached to something else, which may or may not make sense. But then you see the big picture, the puzzle comes together. And that's construction of law. But it's also a problem. It's overdriving a bit. Let me see if I can, oh goodness. This may be a problem trying to figure that out again. I don't know how to use this new Skype, so once I get off the mic, maybe I can try to lower that down a little bit. I'll try to talk a little lower. Is this any better, talking lower? Maybe move my mic a little away. Is that any better, Jen?
Not That's too much. It just sounds like you're talking quieter.
Okay. All right. I got to get up here and try to figure out how to get to the controls again to fix this. What a pain in the neck this thing is. Nothing is simple on here. Anyway, I'm kind of stuck with this for the moment. Construction of law. You know, if you read anybody that's read U.S. 26, it's the worst of all of them. But we don't have to be bothered with those things. I mean, if you're in some kind of a commercial activity that you need to be bothered by it, and you need to understand it, well, then okay. You might want to hire a lawyer that has studied that to give you advice. But generally speaking, we the people are not to be held by statutes. That's what liberty is, free from all positive law, free from government control, free from statutes. We are bound only by the law of the land, only by the true law, because the true law is natural law. Something that really everyone really got to work out and understand that clearly. Now, of course, people don't really understand that. You need to study it, and it'll make sense as you start to see the construction of these things, how it was put together. But anyway, their next move, they've been trying to do this for a while. I heard the call again recently in the last election. They want to get rid of the way that the president is elected through the, what's that system called? The
Electoral College.
Electoral College. They want to get rid of that. But again, that's just taking more power away from the states. Just think about this. 30 states, or more than 30 states, and I think it was 30 states went for Trump. So that left 20 states for Clinton. All right, so 30 states went for Trump. But they say, and I'm not sure this is true either, but they say that Hillary got more votes than him. Well, if he won 30 states, how would Hillary become president? Our founding fathers did not set up a system to elect the president by popular vote. They set up a system which was a compromise, using the people in the states, but giving the states more power and the authority than the people in this process. And the main purpose was that the biggest states would then choose and be able to get the president, you know, elected in their party or whatever, because they have a higher population. They have more cities, more populated cities, more highly populated cities. So all the small states, they really don't get a say then. But with this system that they set up, it kind of levels things out. And it still gives the people partners in this with their state. You know, we're in New York. I'm in New York. You're not New York, but wherever you're at in your state, you get that opportunity to vote in your state to work that popular vote, hopefully, to get elected, the individual you want to get elected. And the state works with that, and then they get the so many votes for that, and it's applied. So many electoral votes, I think it's pronounced. But anyway, there's moves to change that, too. They're changing everything, the whole power structure. The Senate has been totally destroyed. And look at the House of Representatives are destroyed because both the Senate now and the House of Representatives are totally controlled by special interest groups. They chase that funny money, okay? And so, therefore, they're not representing the people. Neither the senators or the House of Representatives are representing the people. They're representing their pockets. Think about this. I recently, you know, through things going on, I found out that President Obama bought a house for $8 million. The man has never held a job in his life. Okay, he went through college and he went right into, as a professor or so. I don't know how they made that man a professor, but he claims he was a professor for a few years, a law professor or something. And, they make okay money, but they don't make that kind of money. Then he became a senator, and then he became the president. Where does he come up with $8 million just to buy the house, you know? Well, of course, something else is going on, and that's the problem. So we don't have anyone that represents us even in the House of Representatives, nor do we have anyone that represents us in the Senate. We have been enslaved. We can go to debtor's prison. Our Constitution is being ignored. They just ignore it. In any court you walk in, you bring in your constitutional rights. They don't care. They trample all over it. You're a slave. You're a subject. 14th Amendment. You're one of their slaves. The states have no power, no authority. Again, they've been enslaved or, you know, subject to the federal government. All power is there. And who controls the federal government? An oligarchy. And how does the oligarchy control that federal government? The deep state. That's their arm, their power. And so they control Congress. They control the Senate. They control the courts. The courts always rule status quo, always, all the time. They control the president. He's just a dictator. Call him a president, but he's really controlled by an oligarchy. That's what we've become. Keep telling us we're a democracy, okay? And we know democracy is two wolves and a lamb trying to decide what's for dinner. So that therein is the problem. So our whole structure, our whole power structure has been destroyed. But we can fix it just by studying and understanding the breakdown of the Declaration of Independence to begin with, okay? The power and the authority of the people to build and do what they please to do, okay? And just starting there alone should empower people to be able to step up and start to realize that they should be sovereign. And I'm going to declare that I'm sovereign. I'm going to deny and call null and void all these things that are repugnant to the Constitution that we the people ordained and established for you guys. And so we have to get power, and we only get power through knowledge. Knowledge is power. More knowledge you have, the more power you got. And you could see that in courts, even though we don't get too many wins in courts, and mostly being thrown out of a court is a win, because usually they drag us into court. So we've had a few of them, but we had more of those than anything else. But, even when you go into court, though, you know, if the judge recognizes you got some knowledge and it's not silly stuff and you've taken it to the next level, they can worry about you. So knowledge is power. If we're going to fix this nation, we need to get knowledge. If we're going to fill the void that's going to be left once this swamp is totally drained and we get all these creatures out of there and they're brought to justice, and there's going to be a large void, a power void. Something has got to fill it. There's going to be a vacuum. Something must fill it. And it's meant for the people to fill it. We, the people. We established. We ordained. We must fill it. Well, if you don't know how and you don't understand that you need to do that, then how are you going to do it? Knowledge is power. You need knowledge. All right. Anyway, that's what the course is all about. That's what the book is going to be all about. We want to empower our sheriffs. We want to empower the people who represent us. We want to take control of our political process. We want to get rid of parties. There is a way and a plan. We do have a plan to get rid of parties, but that's kind of bringing it towards the end, our last part of our plan. And we don't really talk about it much, but it's in there. And getting people involved in the political process without the politics. All right. Jan, we got any questions or any announcements?
Yes. Sorry, I just had a phone call when you were talking, so I'm not exactly sure what you said. And I'd like to add one thing about David Zublik's YouTubes. One or 2 weeks ago, I put a link to one of his YouTubes in the newsletter, and in it he explained that the reporting on these military tribunals will not be given to any of the national news services. Absolutely none of them. They're not going to have a chance to misinform the public. So it will be released to a select group of people like himself that have internet news. So if you want to find out what's going on, and I haven't heard anything yet from them, in terms of releases that could come as written documents or even occasionally some video, but it will be released through people like himself that are in the real news business rather than the fake news business. So if you want to kind of keep an eye on him, or if you know someone else that has said the same, keep an eye on them too to see what's happening with these military tribunals, because we don't really get much of any throughput on them so far. In terms of announcements, it's pretty much the same as last week. We still need a large number of grand jury administrators. We could use some more volunteers. We got quite a few from our special meeting 2 weeks ago Wednesday, but we still could use more, and we still could use some speakers for the natural healing call. Other than that, and I don't see Brent here yet, John, do you want to go into questions or?
I'm looking. Okay, I'm unmuted. How's this? I think I was able to lower my microphone. It was all the way up there. Is this any better?
Yeah, that's good right now.
Okay, good, because I lost the page where I was. I can't find anything on this thing. You know, usually you have on the top file, this, that, or the other thing, and you can go zip through them and they get the drop downs, and you say, oh, there it is, settings. I mean, you got to fish around for them. You can't find nothing. I hate this new Skype.
No.
All right. Anyway, do you have a copy of the call recorder?
Yes, I do.
You do?
You want one?
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it tomorrow, the next day.
Okay.
I'll get it from you. I think I'm going to delete both this and the call recorder and reinstall them and see once if I can work with an older one, because this is really pain in the neck.
Yep.
Okay. No, we don't have any questions. We haven't any questions sent in.
Well, I do have one you can handle, and then this other one is questionable as whether we need to go through it. The first one is, should, in the opinion of NLA, a church or other religious house register as a 501c3 for the purpose of administrating the finances of that institution? And I think you have some things to say about that.
Yeah, I look at you. You got either serve God or Mammon, and or that's it ultimately. No, the people, those churches should not sign up for that because, again, there's a construction of law with that also. There's things that are in effect, but they don't, execute it. They don't enforce it, okay, that are connected to the churches. They can control what you talk about. They could force you to become politically correct in your thinking and reading of the Bible and all those things. It's all part of that game. So I would definitely not participate. I would say people should go learn how to do a common law trust. I will hopefully, I got to get around to this. I'll post the instructions on how to create a common law trust. And then you can open up an account with a bank using a common law trust. And then of course you exercise your life as a free individual inside that common law trust. But don't think that they're not going to try to come out and give you a hard time and a problem. You better understand the process. You have to understand the law. You have to understand the powers and the authorities. Look, you have to take the course because really this course deals with all of these kind of problems. And then you have to be able to defend yourself if you want to go that route. So the 401, what do they call them, 401(c)(3)s or something like that? Is that what they call them?
501c3.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I would say stay away from that. That's just nothing but control. The government should have no say about religion. We have a right to freedom of religion. Congress shall make no law. Just extend it from there. It's an unalienable right. And let me tell you something. You'd be surprised on how many unalienable rights are listed in the Declaration of Independence. I think there's, what did we get, 14? I don't know if you remember, Jan, if you read through that and saw the recapped at the end. I think it was 14 powers that we are given that reveal the fact that we, the people, have as natural human beings that God has given us the authorities over 14 unalienable rights of powers over our government. 14 of them. And people need to know what they are. They need to understand who they are. They need to understand where the power comes from. All right. Anyway, any other questions or is that it?
Well, I did have an item that came in under the questions on the internet, and it deals with apparently a court case this fellow has in Oregon, and what it is a list of 7 questions pertaining to his lawsuit or whatever it was that he sent in, and I'm not sure that they're appropriate because they're related to state of Oregon, county, Lake County, and so on and so forth. I can read one if you want.
Just read one at a time and we'll see how many we'll go through.
Okay, first one starts out. Does the United States and or Oregon, or OR abbreviation, and or State of Oregon and or Lake County, you use in your official capacity have 10th Amendment power over the Union State of Oregon and or its exclusive 1:2:1-3.
States no longer have 10th Amendment powers.
Yeah.
What's next? We already know that because that's what the 17th Amendment stripped the power and the authority, took away the vote of the state in the Senate. Again, the Senate was to choose the leaders in the government and to advise the president and to approve whoever he might bring up to be, a Supreme Court judge or fill this position or that position. And so with the advice of the Senate, which is with the advice of the states, not the people, the states. But they don't have that power no more. And since they are subject now, because they cannot be, they have no power, they have no denial, they have no way to deny the federal government. So with that being the case through the 17th Amendment, they are not sovereign. And since they are not sovereign, they have no power or authority to exercise the 10th Amendment, because if the federal government may decide to allow them or may not decide to allow them, again, it becomes a privilege instead of an unalienable right. And it's a right of the states that we, the people, gave them, and yet the federal government took it away. Therefore, they are not true republics anymore. They are not a true republican form of government. Our states are no longer a true republican form of government. And it becomes very clear when you go through the study that we put together on, which was a very simple study, by the way, through the Declaration of Independence, and you get down to the unalienable right of the people to have free and independent states, okay, and be a republican form, no less. And it's not there no more. It's not there. We, the people, lost our powers because they ignore our Constitution. They made them privileges by the 14th Amendment, no longer unalienable rights. They removed God for the whole subject. They've got rid of courts of law. They claim that statutory courts are courts of record. I was reading that through USC 28 today. And it goes on and on and on. So, yeah, they should be. And again, the only way this is going to be corrected is if the people become aware of it, and they become educated and understanding these things. This is not rocket science. It doesn't take much. Again, you don't get lost in statutes, one statute after another, and most of them don't even make sense, and because it's so hard to figure out. It gives a very complex construction of law system. We don't have to get involved in that because it's very simple. Okay, we have three documents that control our nation. The Declaration of Independence, which is the foundation of our nation, what we are built upon. We're built upon a relationship with a God, with God, an agreement, a covenant with God, and that we want Him as King to rule in our courts, and we are able to exercise unalienable rights as long as we are morally minded and obedient. Of course, everyone isn't going to be that. Most people aren't going to be that. But the heart of the country can be. It used to be. It was back in 1776 and 1789. Most of the people who put our government together were godly people. Very few of them were not. Very few of these people were not. And so we have to get back to that to fix it. But it all starts with knowledge. The people expect to be ignorant and free. Forget about it. Not going to happen. All right, what else?
Okay, have you and or your United States and or Capo Capor and or State of Oregon and or Lake County ever made any claims, judgments, demands, or instructions against a trust or other fictional character that sounds like my name in a fictional place and for
it's a game of words. It's construction of law.
Yep.
It has application to some degree, not as much as people think, because it's not the look at you. You really got to get to the people to enforce the law that they took an oath to obey. That's where the fight's got to be. Everything else is fraud. Everything else is just construction of fraud, really, not construction of law. But there are still pieces of that that I think are not there yet, that haven't been inserted yet to really make the clinch. And that would happen if things continued the way they were before Trump. It would have eventually happened. They would have put the clinchers in there, ratcheted everything down, removed some stuff, and you would be in such a tight, constructive, statutory prison, you wouldn't be able to move right or left without running into stress and problems and sufferings and by the government, which we already go through. We're already in tort. But it's heading there. It's not there yet. To make that battle in court, it doesn't get you anywhere. Forget about it. They're not going to bring it up. You shouldn't bring it up. Focus in on the Constitution, their oath, their bonds, hold their feet to the fire, get knowledge, and be able to apply it. You have to have all those things, because if you don't have the knowledge or you can't apply it and you don't know how to apply it, you got to have all those tools. But a lot of people are falling for a lot of stuff on the Internet that, and again, I fell for it too. So I kind of have the knowledge of that stuff. I'm glad I got some knowledge of that stuff. And I was able to put it in perspective, just as I was able to put U.S. codes into perspective. They have a place. We gave authorities. They've worked out properly, but they did bring in their evil construction of fraudulent law, and have been manipulating and changing things over the years and building this statutory prison. So, but yeah, don't get lost in those caps and all that stuff. I certainly, when I write my papers, I don't use caps though. I just don't make a thing about it, and I don't say why. They can do all the capping they want. I couldn't care less. Stop yelling at me, what I'll tell them. All right, what else you got? How many more are there? You have to unmute yourself. Jan, did we lose you? Terry, am I here?
Yep, I was muted. Sorry about that, John. Next one is... hold on a second.
Hang up. Button
on. Are your bar attorneys and or judges agents of foreign principals, and have they registered as such?
Well, look, they are in a sense because that's how they act. Again, like I told you, like I said before, everything has not been inserted. There are pieces of the law that still have not been put in there to click it and sort of bring the hammer down. It's not there yet. But most of the pieces are there ready for that. And again, thank God for Trump, that he sent the Trump, and that that things are happening the way it's happening. Otherwise, I think we would have been well into it at this point. Yeah, look, they kind of are because they maintain the status quo, so they're really working for the bankers because they're under that stress. Ultimately, it is the bankers that's pressing them. It's usually the IRS, the Federal Reserve, or the Fed itself, you know, or the federal government, that pressure of control. But, like I said, there's pieces missing yet, and we're going a different direction. I know there was something else I wanted to say about that, but I forgot. Can you just summarize that quickly, and maybe I can think about it? Jan?
He just wanted to...
Yeah, I lost you again. Just wanted to what? Jen, we're not getting anything if you're talking. Jen? Terry, are you hearing me?
Yes, I am. No problem.
You're not hearing Jen, are you?
I'm not hearing Jen.
Okay. All right, so what we'll do... see if Jan's back. Right, let me move over to Q&A. Anybody that's got questions or comments, hit *6 and then 1 to get into the queue. But it'll be a little while longer before we get to start, you know, taking questions. Jan, last call for you. If I don't get you, I'll move to Brent. All right, we'll deal with the rest of those questions, I guess, that Jan's got after Brent. Brent, are you ready to take over the mic?
Yes.
Okay, let me introduce Brent. Brent, this is Brent Winters. He is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com, and Brent's going to teach us something tonight. Go right ahead, Brent. You got the mic.
I'm sorry, did you turn it over to me? I went blank for a minute. Hello?
Yes. Yes, he did.
Oh, thank you. Well, this is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com. And my comments today are my own. I take responsibility for them and may not necessarily be the opinions of the leaders or the members of National Liberty Alliance. But we're talking about our Constitution of the United States. We're in Article 1. We've been going through the Declaration of 76 clause by clause and blow by blow. And we've gotten out to we're to the point in our Constitution of the United States where we're talking about bankruptcy jurisdiction. Bankruptcy jurisdiction is a power our Constitution grants only to the federal government. And the Constitution, as a matter of law, not as of reality always, but as a matter of law, the Constitution presents the federal government in Washington, D.C. as having no powers, that the Constitution of the United States does not specifically and expressly give to it. And if the powers aren't given, the government of the United States sitting in Washington, D.C. simply doesn't have those powers. But bankruptcy is an exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts. State courts have no power to, no authority, I should be more precise, no authority to do away with debts. You see, doing away with debts is doing away with obligations of a contract. Contract and debt they're inseparable. Show me a contract and I'll show you a debt. Show me a debt and I'll show you a contract. In fact, that's what contract is. It's exchanges of debt. If you do this, I'll do that. As it is said, and this relates directly to our common law of contract, a promise made is a debt unpaid. A promise made is a debt unpaid. That's what common law contract is. And if people make a promise or an undertaking by their actions or by their words or some way express it, then if the other side has made some kind of a commitment as well, that's called consideration. I don't know why they use that word. There have been a lot of other people say that's a dumb word to use. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't even seem to relate. But that's what we call it when people make mutual exchange of promises, exchange value. Then we call that consideration. Well, if contracts have been made, the state courts have no jurisdiction to impair them. As a matter of fact, our Constitution says that no state legislature has the authority to impair an obligation of contract. Contract is held sacrosanct, or it used to be, and the courts have said that, but it hasn't been held that sacred in recent decades. But it ought to be, because a contract is a matter of relationship. You choose to enter a contract, and you choose, according to our freedom of association, under the First Amendment, not under it, under the protection of it, I should say. A contract is one of those relationships you have freedom to enter in at your choice, or not enter in. Same way with the relationship of marriage, same way with every relationship you have with every person. Even with God himself, that's called freedom of religion. That's another species of freedom of relationship, or freedom of association, which is freedom of relationship. Our Constitution uses freedom of association. So contract is protected under the First Amendment as a matter of freedom of association. And the only courts that have the formidable power to undo that are the bankruptcy courts of the United States. Section 8, Clause 4 of Article 1 says that Congress has authority I'm quoting, to establish a uniform rule of naturalization, and, it says, uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. If states had power to break contracts as a sovereign, they gave up that power. But if they had that power to do that, there wouldn't be any interstate commerce. You wouldn't be able to make a deal, a business deal, with a man across the state line. Sooner or later, the confusion would be so overwhelming, all the states granting bankruptcy protection, which means to do away with an obligation of a contract. That's why they did this. They said, we're going to give it to the federal courts, and the federal courts alone. Our Constitution empowers Congress to control immigration. That's what it says here, establish uniform rule of naturalization. To control immigration and to set a standard for immigrants to become citizens that courts are to apply uniformly, but never arbitrarily. That's the meaning of the word uniform. Uniform means the same for everybody, but never arbitrarily. And this clause, Section 8, Clause 4, called Bankruptcy Clause, and also the Naturalization Clause, also gives Congress exclusive power to set bankruptcy laws throughout the United States. The Constitution gives Congress, therefore, the exclusive power of bankruptcy jurisdiction. Article 1, Section 10 is the part of the Constitution that bars the state legislatures of any state from doing that which bankruptcy protection requires, impairing an obligation of contract. That means canceling the burden of a promisor's debt. A man makes a promise, I'll pay you this if you give me that, or I'll give you this if you pay me that. And the only way you can cancel that burden, it is a burden that you have put upon yourself if you enter a contract. There's no such thing as a common law contract where there aren't burdens on both sides, both parties. Me promising you I'll give you $100 in the contract. It's a promise, but there's no reciprocal promise from you. That doesn't apply to bankruptcy court. We're talking about contracts. If our Constitution never barred state legislatures from impairing contractual obligations, in other words, debts, they no doubt would favor their own residents. If you two people across state lines make a deal, they're going to favor, especially if the resident of one state is a very powerful party who pays lots of taxes and controls a lot of business and government because of his sway and influence. Or maybe he's a politician. I knew a preacher once that went, and his wife went also to federal prison for 5 years apiece because they were building, or they were not them, but the church that they pastored, South Indianapolis, Indiana, were building a church, a bigger building, and they had to go into court to stop a factory from pumping sludge over onto their property before they started building the church. Well, unbeknownst to them, one of the chief benefactors of that factory was a powerful state senator. And before they knew what was happening, they were indicted by a federal grand jury. It's a true story. It's that simple. Friends with the wrong man on the wrong day, or enemies with the wrong man on the wrong day, it gets you in trouble. And that's what happened in this case, but they didn't know it. They didn't know. Well, even if they'd have known this fellow had an interest in this factory, how could they have known that he was so doggone crooked? That's one of the first rules of getting involved in government. Remember that, as was said to Charlton Heston in that movie, Ben-Hur, that old Arab said to him, remember, in the arena, there is no law. Well, that's the way it is in some of this government business. No, there's no law. They may say there is, but there isn't. It's every man for himself. Dangerous business. Well, if states had bankruptcy jurisdiction. The free-flowing regularity of American commerce would grind to a halt. Where state courts cannot enforce promises of contract, prosperity ends. Let me repeat that. Where state courts cannot enforce promises of contract, prosperity ends. When government grants protection from creditors under bankruptcy law, it sets aside promises. That means obligations and debts of otherwise enforceable contracts. And our Constitution provision for bankruptcy being allowed to a person once every 7 years is in principled accord with the law of the Bible, canceling all debt every 7 times 7 years, every 49 years. And that's in accord with our common law tradition. And I'm going to quote here on that point the fellow that was on the Supreme Court longer than about anybody, the Supreme Court of the United States. His name is Justice Joseph Story. And he says this in his celebrated commentaries on the Constitution of the United States. He says, a government that never offers relief from a slavery of mind and body by ending the debt of the debtor trapped for life is incompatible with the first precepts of Christianity and is a living reproach to the nations of Christendom. Notice he doesn't include anybody else in that, just the nations of Christendom. Because indeed, nations that live under the sway of other religious points of view are part of the evil empire. That includes most of the world, no matter what they say about themselves. Carrying them, he says, if they don't have that, in other words, something equivalent or comparable to bankruptcy, it carries them back to the worst ages of paganism. Justice Joseph Story of the United States Constitution. So in short, says Solomon, the borrower is slave to the lender. And slavery without hope of relief, whether self-inflicted or inflicted by another, flies in the face of both the Bible and our common law. And remember that phrase of our Declaration of 76, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, according to William Blackstone in his commentaries of 1765 on the laws of England, that phrase refers to the two volumes of law, the only two volumes under which all true law must fall, the laws of nature, that's our common law, and the laws of nature's God, says Blackstone, is the Bible. One is written, the Bible is written in particular, the other is unwritten, lex non scripta, and more generally applicable to all men. The Bible isn't applicable to all men, but all men won't pay attention to it. The laws of nature, all men pay attention to that or they die immediately or are terribly injured. The laws of nature's God, men don't pay attention to that. They could die immediately, but certainly they will not live in breath eternally. And that was his point. That's the point of William Blackstone, and that is our fundamental law. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 says that Congress has the power, the authority, to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and the value of foreign coin, and to fix the standard of weights and measures. Now, this clause demands uniform and fixed nationwide standards of weights and measures for commodities, including gold and silver, so that trade will stay regular, that is, free-flowing. It empowers Congress alone to coin money. Congress alone to coin money, not to print it. Now, when I say Congress alone to coin money, I mean of the powers, the different powers of government. Congress has the power to coin money. Anybody else ought to have the power to coin. Well, they do. Anybody else has the power to coin money. As long as they don't make it look like money in the United States, I've read cases of men prosecuted in federal court that unintentionally they coined coins of gold and silver, and they really believed that they were sufficiently different from the coinage of the United States, but the government didn't like them doing that, so they went after them and prosecuted them, had them, got them indicted by a grand jury, and it just caused all sorts of problems. If you ever want to coin money, and you have the lawful right to do that, just be careful you don't come close to making it look like an American coin, one that the U.S. government, through the power of Congress, coins. It is a fact that non-government coins of money for decades in our country were the most prevailing available coinage in the country. Until World War One in Northern California, and that includes the northern half of the state, the primary currency was privately coined gold. There was hardly any government coins to be found in Northern California. And I've been in places in the state still, in the mining states, where I don't know what it's like now, but 30, 40 years ago, the raw commodity of gold was a lot of the transactions were done with the raw commodity of gold because it was available. And there isn't a law against doing that. Just a fellow has to be careful. But of the government, Congress alone has the power to coin money, not to print money. Congress has no power to print money. No part of our government has any authority to print money. As a matter of fact, remember, if the Constitution doesn't specifically and expressly grant the power by its words, then the government of the United States, the federal government, the general government, all those words have been used, then there is no authority to do such a thing. Paper money, as a matter of constitutional law, is against the law, period. Nobody argues about that. Everybody you talk to that knows about it, knows a lot about it, will say, yeah, that's what the Constitution says. As Judge Bork used to say, it gets to the point after 70 or 80 years of ignoring the law that it becomes custom. That's the bad thing about ignoring law. And these standards are here for a very important reason. So Congress has the power to coin it, and the coin money, not print it, and to regulate its value. That means to fix its value, never to change it. Congress, however, has ignored its duty to keep regular our dollar. And it's passed legislation giving private bankers monopoly over the power to manipulate money, its value. Listen, if Congress has the authority, according to this clause, it says, to regulate the value, what does that mean? That means to keep it where they want to keep it. The who? Congress. Congress alone. Then how is it that the Federal Reserve bankers have the power to inflate or deflate money? That's what they do. They do it through the IRS, by the taking of money out in income taxes, take out more money, raise taxes, take out more money, increase enforcement, and that helps them. The feds, the Federal Reserve Bank, the private bank, helps them regulate how they want the value of money to be, whether they want to inflate it or otherwise. And as you know, it's obvious. If you've lived at all, you know that inflation has been increasing steady. That's not Congress that's doing that. You say, well, Congress delegated authority to the Federal Reserve Bank to do those things. No, Congress doesn't have authority to delegate that authority. Our Constitution delegated it to them. And no place does our Constitution say that Congress has the power to give it to anybody else. Matter of fact, the redelegation of authority is not lawful under our Constitution. The President of the United States cannot delegate to Congress his authority as commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States. That's just an example. That'd be, you say, well, that's ridiculous. Of course not. Well, then why is it ridiculous that Congress claims they have the power to redelegate authority to a private bank? But that's what they do. Congress has ignored its duty. Using legislation, giving private bankers monopoly to manipulate the worth, the value of the dollar, while barring any audit of the Federal Reserve Bank. That's unlawful. But they've done it, and the government apparently follows it. The Fed is not audited. Nobody, but nobody knows what goes on the books of the Federal Reserve Bank. And they've got it wrapped up so tight that you can't even find out what goes on in a little bank in a little town that's, of course, all the banks are connected to the Federal Reserve System and insured by the United States. You can't even find out what goes on in a little bank in a little town. I can tell you that for sure. Last year, I was involved 6 weeks of litigation against a bank, and I cross-examined the bank president, the officers for hours, trying to find out what was going on. And what I found out was shocking to me. If you don't get inside the evil empire, you don't work in there, you don't know. And to try to find out even in court is almost impossible. Almost impossible. But how in the world are we going to get to the heart of the problem, which is the Federal Reserve Bank? That was the chief push of Ron Paul, was to, if you remember, audit the Fed. He put it up for vote on a number of occasions. It never really got anywhere. So the Federal Reserve Bank, therefore, has a monopoly. Monopoly. Mono means one. Poly. That means one of many powers into one, and it combines them all, power over all. And when it comes to banking, they control everything. Well, monopolies are against the law. Against the law. Because they're against our Constitution. Why are they against our Constitution? Because they're against our common law. Our Constitution is a beef of common law government. Let me quote Sir Edward Coke. Sir Edward Coke, a judge, a justice in England, quoted by the political founders of our country, quoted more than any other person. Now, they only quoted the Greeks and the Romans as bad examples. But Edward Coke, they quoted him to show how it's supposed to be. Edward Coke is best known for his commentaries on Magna Carta. He said this, all monopolies are against the Great Charter. What is the Great Charter? That is Magna Carta. Magna is Latin for great, and charter, or carta, means charter. Charter in Latin really means white. It means the big white paper. That's what Magna Carta is. Magna Carta, he said all monopolies are against the Great Charter because they are against the liberty and freedom of the subject. That means the Englishman. And against the law of the land. You see, monopolies have always been against the law. That's why it said that our Constitution, our federal law, says that it fundamentally forbids such things. To regulate the value of money means to keep its worth fixed to the steady standard, that Congress sets forth. Now, in the past, they've done that by saying it's tied to gold and silver. And I remember when I was a boy, we had silver certificates. The federal government issued dollar bills that looked just like, pretty much like the dollar bills we have now. But on the $1 bill, it had George Washington. But at the bottom, it said redeemable. I forget the words, but I think I saved some around here when I was a kid. Redeemable for $1 worth of silver in the federal treasury. That's not the words it had, but that's what it meant by what it said. The paper money was backed by gold and silver. Oh, you say, that's good. Oh, it's okay. That's still against the law. The Constitution gives no authority for paper money. None. Not by the federal government. Now, if you want a paper money, is nothing more than a promissory note. To make it easy, I mean, fundamentally, that's what it is. It's a little different, but a dollar bill is supposed to be a promissory note. It's a note. That's why we call them notes. What's a note? Well, that's short for promissory note. It's an expression of a promise. I promise to pay you $100. And you write it down on a piece of paper, give it to the other fellow by June the 4th. Put a date on there. And that's a negotiable piece of paper. He can sign that over to somebody else if he wants. Just like you can give a dollar bill over to somebody else, then he can give it to somebody else. There are different rules for different kinds of notes. A promissory note is one that you sign over to somebody else. A dollar bill is one that has your authority. You can give it, just give it. Whoever bears it, whoever has it, has the power of using that money, even if it isn't signed. That's a different set of rules for a different kind of note. But they're all fundamentally the same thing. Promissory notes and contracts can be sold that way. They're promises. Promises to pay money. And the Constitution forbids the federal government from issuing paper promises. That's the way to make it simple. The Constitution of the United States bars the federal government from issuing paper promises written on paper. Why? Well, the founders knew that governments as entities are liars. That's just the way it is. It's always been that way, always will be. It doesn't say on our money in government we trust. It says there in God we trust. What does that mean? Well, it means the negative of what it says, too. It means we don't trust government. We don't trust other men. We don't even trust ourselves. Well, that's what the Bible teaches, too, by the way. Paul the Apostle even said, I don't trust what you say, and I don't even trust what I think about myself. I'd be foolish to do that. I'm not that smart. But I do trust my Maker to tell me what I should think about myself. And you get along better that way doing that. And that's why we have on that unlawful paper money, at least it does say, in God we trust, but we have it on our coins too. Well, for the same reason our Constitution empowers Congress to set the standard for a pound and a ton, a peck and a bushel, a quart and a gallon, so that all are always confident and never hesitant to buy and sell. You pull up to the pump at the gasoline station and you start pumping and it says you've got 14 gallons, you trust that that's true. If you had to stop and calibrate and measure the gallons every time you bought fuel, travel and shipment of goods and trucks and all that would just slow down it would stall out. We don't do that. We say, government, you have responsibility to make sure and police these carriers and sellers of gasoline so that we know that the pumps are calibrated, we can run in, grab the gas, and keep moving. It's worked pretty well for us. That's all, by the way, see, part of the Constitution. The Constitution of the United States says that Congress, throughout the nation, has the power to set the standard for a bushel, for a peck, for a gallon. And Congress has done that. I've been to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and they have in there just a whole lot of interesting things. One of the things they have is a bushel basket made of brass. A bushel basket made of brass. Why do they have a bushel basket made of brass? Because that bushel basket made of brass was the bushel basket that Congress authorized to a metalsmith to make to be the standard for a bushel in the United States. They wanted it made out of brass so it would last. We had a lot of bushel baskets when I was growing up. We had them everywhere because you'd buy apples in bushel baskets and peck baskets back then. A peck's a fourth of a bushel. And we had bushel baskets, and I noticed they didn't last real long. But they were all made on the standard of that brass basket. By the way, brass does shrink with temperature and expand with temperature to some degree. And that has given rise to a very famous saying, a nautical saying that came from the British Navy that when we say in America, we talk about a monkey and how cold it might be. It's so cold it'll freeze, and then we talk about the monkey. Well, that has to do with cannonballs. that used to sit on a brass plate on the deck of warships, where they would be stacked, and the brass plate has holes in it so that the cannonballs could be stacked. But in really cold weather, the brass plate would shrink, and the holes were the cannonballs set to keep them from rolling around on the deck, which sometimes shrink enough that the cannonballs would roll around a little bit. It'd be that cold. So brass does shrink a little, and that bushel basket wasn't perfect, but it was pretty stable, and we all knew what a bushel was back in those days. Well, for the same reason, of course, our Constitution had said empowers Congress to set the standard for a pound and a ton, a peck, a bushel, and to keep things regular, unchanging, so we have confidence to buy, sell, and trade without stopping and measuring everything. All the confusion and distress in America, and I'm quoting John Adams here, all the confusion and distress in America comes not from defects in the Constitution, nor from want of honor or virtue, as much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation of money. Now, he said that a long time ago, and it is because of that ignorance that the bankers think that we hoi polloi, the unwashed masses, don't understand money, and they can just do anything they want and tell us it's all right, it's okay, this isn't what you think it is. They're liars. Bankers, by definition, are liars. Maybe a banker listening to this call. You live in a culture of lies. You live in it. You operate in one. You'll tell yourself otherwise. You'll say otherwise. I say this gently. I really believe that many people that work in banks don't have a clue what they're doing. I don't think they understand banking. They're just told to do this specific thing. I knew a lawyer once. Still know him. He got out of a law school, made really good grades. He's a lot younger than I am. And he got a job in Germany working for one of the international banks. He was there for, 7 or 8 years. Boy, did he make a lot of money right off the jump. A lot of money. But he quit. And the reason he quit, he told me, was because he couldn't stand it anymore. He said even in the banks, the people in those big banks where the money is really flowing back, this was just before the big bust back in 2008 and 2009, he said people are zombies in banks. Those big banks where you really don't have any contact with anybody except just to make money and nobody questions what you do. So they're zombies. They just walk around like zombies, have a lot of money, and enjoy filling their lust with all the money they have. He said, I couldn't deal with it anymore. And it finally got to the point they were asking me or telling me to do things that I knew were unlawful, and I just couldn't live with it anymore. He came back to the States, and he trying to struggle practicing law. Well, I've talked long enough. I think I'll quit here. I'll mark this spot, and whoever's got the mic to take it back, Oh, there you are. Okay. Thank you.
I got it. Thank you. Appreciate it, Brent. Okay. We'll go over to, I guess, the Q&A. If anybody's got a question or a comment, star 6, and then a 1 to get into the queue. We've got a few people in the queue right now, but anybody else wants to get in there, star 6, and then a 1. Any questions or comments for myself or for Brent, go right ahead. Okay, let's take our first caller, and let's see, it is Crystal from Connecticut. How you doing, Crystal? You got the mic. Crystal, you've been unmuted. Crystal?
Yeah, hi.
There you go, we got you.
Okay.
How you doing?
Hanging in there.
Sounds like you're under stress.
Yeah. Could you hold on 1 second, please? Wait this. I had an incident that happened to me on Saturday. I told you about, you know, these illegal foreclosures and stuff and all the paperwork
right.
that I put in place. and I had some other stuff. I was going to get this stuff mailed up, but it was so cold, and I hadn't been feeling good. And so I got some papers I definitely got to send you, which is going to be very helpful. And it, all my paperwork, everything has been recorded. I got my, you know, my warranty deed, life use, that where they have no power, and also the affidavits is everything is, the volume page has been recorded, notarized, and all. And I submitted them all to the in the court documents and what they've been doing here. They've been stealing people's homes left and right. They never went through the documents. And also these documents I got to send you, I'll make sure I'm going to send you the blank forms on it. Okay, because it's personal information on it, but I'll try to get that over to you tomorrow. They were all certified from the appellate federal superior intern, the attorneys, all the judges, everyone got certified copies of it. And I've also made several, I also faxed it to them. Do you know, on Saturday morning when I was on my way out, the police was in my yard, and the attorney was there, and so he got out and asked me my name three times, and I wouldn't answer him, so the police officer said, oh, yes, that's who she is. And I said, first of all, why are you here? And you are trespassing on my property. And they said, we're here, we're going to foreclose on your property. And but before I let me go back, the attorney...
Did you tell him you needed the sheriff to do that? Which I know you don't have sheriffs out there no more, but go ahead.
Listen. When... remember the attorney, the judge that recused himself from my case? The one that started all this mess, Jennings, in the beginning? Well, do you know, 2 weeks ago he came back, and he goes, I saw that you wrote me up again. We're taking your house. I said, under what grounds? I said, first of all, you recused yourself from my case. You have no jurisdiction. You are a foreign agent under the Public Act of 1938. You are not registered, and you have no jurisdiction over me. He goes, this is my court. I'll do what I want. Dismissed. We're taking the house on the state. And then prior to that, the other woman who came in and replaced when he recused himself from my case, Bruno, she goes, well, I can't really do anything because I have no jurisdiction. I said, you're absolutely right. I said, so I would like this case dismissed. I did all those paperwork and the, you know. So now, when I sent those that last set, now they brought Jennings back, okay? And then on Friday evening, I received a letter from the court because I brought my medical records and everything in. And by the way, another person, because I had ended up in the hospital, the other person that came to my house, she was having to go to bed, and she's in the hospital. People are, you know, the stress is unbelievable. She said, so she goes, well, we're going to be taking your house. So they said, well, we want to do it on the 19th. So she goes, no, that's a holiday. She goes, we can't do it. We can't foreclose on people on, it's a holiday weekend. And unbeknownst to me, I didn't realize the weekend she was talking about this January, the January 19th.
Mm-hmm.
And so, she goes, we could do it on the 23rd. So the attorney goes, no, we can't do it on the 23rd because she'll be able to keep her house. And we got to do it on the 19th. She goes, well, we don't foreclose on the 19th. So they went out and they walked up to her and they go, okay, very well, it'll be the 19th. Now, all the other cases, she would not do it on the 19th because they don't foreclose properties on the holidays or whatever the case is.
Or a holiday weekend coming into a holiday, yeah.
The holiday weekend, exactly. Exactly. And so, me being that, you know, is Martin Luther King, and I am a minority. I'm a black woman. So when they came here, he said, okay, well, we want to come in your house and look around. I said, I will not allow you in my house. And I said, and you do not step on my property. I said, you see the no trespassing on my house, on my fence, and all that. And he goes, okay, well, we're going to go in your yard and we're going to walk around so the people can walk around and there's nothing you can do about that. So the police officer said, why are you here? I spoke to him again, why are you here? You know? And he said, because we're going to, he goes, so there won't be no problems. The attorney called the police on you and had us to be here for the next 4 hours. Well, really? And it's so, and then so meanwhile, I was, you know, I was shaken up somewhat because, as I said, I was, it was totally, caught me off guard. So I made a few calls and stuff like that. And also, this is, the media came and all that stuff, too. So then I, friend called and she goes, what's the matter? And I said, the police are here. She goes, for what? I said, for what? She goes, the sheriff? I said, oh, my God. She goes, is the sheriff there? I said, oh, my God, that's right. So I went back out. And meanwhile, I guess they had their friends to come and supposedly to make their so-called bid. And
yeah, Connecticut created themselves a big problem with that, but go ahead.
So the cop goes, I said, first of all, here's my documents. He goes, so the police says, he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. He goes, you have to speak to the attorney on that. And so I got ready to turn around and walk, and he goes, I suggest you not do that because you'll be in big trouble if you say anything to him, and then I will have to arrest you. Okay. And, and that's when I came. I came back to the house, and that's when I got the call. And they mentioned the sheriff. And I went back on. I said, "Excuse me, where is the sheriff, and where is the affidavits and the paperwork?" I said, "I was never served." And I said,
"That's right.
By the way,
you got to make that clear in order for them to execute a warrant." They not only have to have the paper from the court signed by a judge, but it has to be accompanied with a sworn affidavit. And that you could pull out of the Constitution directly, but go ahead.
Okay. So all of a sudden...
Right out of the Bill of Rights, I believe the Fifth.
All of a sudden, the Fourth. The police officer, because he was a little, you know, cocky at that point. All of a sudden, his face turned red. I said, and by the way, why are you here? This is not a criminal case. This is a civil case. So why are you here? You have no jurisdiction. Why are you here? You're trespassing also.
By the way,
is Chief Lombard, I said, well, I said, who's in charge today? So all of a sudden, he didn't know how to answer me because he didn't, you know, because he said, Krausner is the one who called to have the police here. So I guess he must have called over to him. So meanwhile, one of the friends of mine came by, and they were doing all this recording. So then all of a sudden I saw the attorney get out, and now he got these dark shades on. So I turned and I said, look, take his picture. That's him right there. And he went running on the side of the police car. And meanwhile, the lady who was with them, she had come back with like four or five cups of coffee, and they were all laughing and joking, and all of a sudden it got quiet. Next thing, it was like you didn't hear a sound. Then all of a sudden I seen the attorney run, jump in his car. The three other people, they went running across the street. The woman took all the coffee and the cups, threw it in the neighbor's garbage can. They all jumped in their car. The cops went spinning out my yard, and they all took off. So everybody goes, what's going on?
That's very strange, huh?
They all left, yeah.
And did the police leave, too?
Oh, they sped out of here, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
When I asked,
right.
You're
going to want to file another paper with the court because tomorrow's the day after the holiday. So you might want to try to file this by tomorrow. But make the point that they showed up and that everything they were doing was unlawful, that there was no constitutional officer here. No police officer can execute a warrant to take the property, especially one that's been claimed to be going through a court. That has to be done by a constitutional officer, and that, of course, is the sheriff. He's the one that has to come out and serve and then take possession of something and so on. You could read about the details of that in the Fourth Amendment. And the other thing is that as I mentioned, and I think you mentioned also, the affidavit, that is key. And it says right here in the Constitution, warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. So you got to get your oath. They got to have their sworn affidavit there claiming that they've got the possession of this lawfully. And they have to have, there are two things that, again, that I've brought up, and I'm sure you brought it up in the court. They have to have fiduciary authority, which that court does not have, nor has the court the power, the authority to give that fiduciary authority to anyone. And the other thing they have to have is they have to have a proof of claim, and that requires a sworn affidavit, which they would never, ever do because that's fraud and they know it. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place there. And then they have to come with the warrant that shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by that affidavit, and particularly describing, whatever it is, the thing to be seized, which in their case is the house. So Mr. GE has got to do an affidavit. And I know that he hasn't done one yet.
No real GE. As a matter of fact, mine is beyond that. Okay, literally and legally, they have no jurisdiction whatsoever where I have all my warranty deeds. They never show proof of claim. Anything over $20, they denied me of my common law grand jury. Every single document and every act, which I'm going to send you the paper, because I'm not even in their jurisdiction.
I know that you filed or tried to file something with the federal court. I'm not sure exactly what you did or how you did it.
There's something major that was that cost me over almost $300. The paperwork that I have, it's going to be helpful for all of you. It's a powerful document with all notarized. I don't want to go over it with you, but it's all on my records. They couldn't, Mr. Bugs Bunny couldn't touch his paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Everything is notarized. It is, has the volume page. It's all recorded on my land records. Like I said, even before all this, I filed this. I said, who is going to change my documents? I have life use of my property for 100 years. It's this property. I got a patent. This property stays in my family's name, my grand, for the next 500 years. But I can turn around and put this in there for heir property, just like with the Kennedys, private trust and all that. There's a lot of things that people definitely need to know. My life use and everybody who has property, and if you're a certain age, get it out your name. Give yourself the life use, remaining owner, okay, and whoever you're going to leave it to for how long. You can't do a thing. You don't have to go through probate or nothing like that. That's the work I did, John, for God, since 75. And I learned that from the old attorneys who later became judges. Today, they won't tell you nothing about life use. They won't tell you about air property, you know. They won't tell you.
Well, maybe you could maybe you could sit down and write a simple instruction paper concerning that, and give us the form that you might have used. You know, the.
Oh, I put it together.
I'm sure you made it up yourself. The
oh, I did. And,
that,
and
yeah.
You know what? You got what I did, and then like with the quick claim, you go to Staples. You know, because I did it for my mother. I've done it for people all around the country, and I tell them all the time. Get everything out your name, and see, that will protect your property. And so, God forbid, if you got get sick and got to go in the convalescent home, for example, it was 23 years ago today, on the 21st of January, when my mother collapsed. And she died in August of that year, August 14th. And I did that for my mother's property, oh, God, back in the 80s. Thank God we did all that, because from her hospital bill to the convalescent home, back to the hospital, the convalescent home, it came to at 1996. Her bill, medical bills, hospital, and all that stuff came to about $119,000. Mm-hmm. Do you know how much we paid for everything?
Mm-hmm.
Not 1 cent, because it was under Title 19. And she got the best of the care. And
well, again, you know, try to write a paper and give us the forms that you created. You know, just take out your name and private information out of it. That's all. Get it to me. Let me try to put it together maybe put it up online for other people. And
yeah,
but you need to give them some instructions. But still, there are two things. What do they do in Connecticut? Who has taken the place of the sheriff? And what do they call that person? And I know they're appointed, I believe, by the governor.
The state marshals.
Okay, so they're marshals. Now, they're appointed by the governor, correct?
Right, and we got a new governor.
So let me ask you some questions, though. Let me ask you a few mm-hmm. questions. You see, if the president of the United States appoints a marshal, okay, that's a federal position, and that position has a period of time, the president cannot call back that marshal. He's a court officer. He's like appointing a judge. You know, he can't say, oh, I don't like this guy anymore, and I'm going to take him back out. No, he's got to fulfill his position of time. And I believe it was Marbury versus Madison. I'm sure it was Marbury versus Madison that covers this particular kind of a situation with the appointees from a president. And so if the president appoints, of course, with the agreement of Congress, you know, the advice of Congress is how the advice and approval of Congress. then if you're going to follow that process of a marshal, I got to believe then the governor has to go the same route. And if the governor goes the same route and appoints an individual, that governor cannot pull that person back. But you got to look into the law to see what controls these individuals, how the statutes are, which for them would be the policies and procedures, which also gives them the authorities and the power to act this way or that way. So you got to dig that stuff up and see where they're at. The other thing is the only way to remove, it's like a sheriff being elected or any other individual being elected or any other court-appointed powers that on this level. You know, they, in order for them to be removed, they can only be removed if they are impeached or indicted, okay? They can be indicted. So those are the only two ways I know that they could be removed. Now, how does the state set that up? You want to look up that law. You need to understand that individual, who they are, by what authority. And then the other thing you want to find out, do they understand? If they're appointed and cannot be removed from power until their time period, you know, the appointment time is fulfilled, then the next thing you want to know is, do they understand that? You see, that empowers them to continue in a proper fashion. In other words, they're free to obey the Constitution as they understand it. And then that person could, in theory, you know, and I want to say this in theory, because this is not a proper way to do things, in my opinion, and I don't know that I could support that. But I will try to, you know, do my research. But they, in theory, has the same power and authority as a sheriff, okay? Remember, what we have to go off of is the U.S. Marshals, okay? That's what we have to go off of. Now, the U.S. Marshals, of course, they go out and get their deputies, you know, and I don't know what they call the deputies. They're marshals also, but I guess they're deputy marshals. And, of course, they could be removed from power by the marshal. Marshal can fire anybody, hire anybody and fire anybody. But no one can move that marshal for that district. Each district has a U.S. marshal. The other thing, you know, and I discovered, I believe it was 1970, the federal government, for instance, the federal courts, did not have the power or the authority to call a grand jury. You know, so there was no rules, regulations, let's call them statutes, because that's what they would be. It would be a power of statute under some title. And then that their powers would be and their authorities would be described. But it was 1970 when Congress issued, I think it was 1970, when they issued the ability or the power, the authority for the federal, the U.S. attorneys to be able to call a grand jury. And what that was all about, really, I think, and again, I haven't completed my research in this area yet, but what I'm thinking is that before that, you know, they didn't have the penal code, okay? The penal code is found in U.S. C. 18. And U.S. C. 18, okay, if you look up the jurisdiction, is maritime law or admiralty, okay? So it's maritime or admiralty, which means it's at sea and not at the land. And they get away with this. And U.S. C. 28, which are the rules of the court, you know, the procedures that cover and the rules that cover all of the statutes, okay, but it gives the process, the rules of procedure, evidence procedures, and different procedures of the court, and so on and so forth. It's sort of a policies and procedures, but they're statutes. So it's a process, the statutes by which they operate. If they don't have the authority by statute, then they don't have the authority at all. My point is this, and this is where I'm trying to get to. What authority has been given to the marshals, number one? Then you need to make a decision on whether you should contact that marshal or not. The second thing is that this police officer, which was probably a town cop?
Yeah.
Okay. That town cop, you need to go to see what statutes control him. You know, you do a little research online in Connecticut for the town.
Listen, the main thing... Which you know about the Foreign Agent Act, right?
Well, I don't know the details.
I sent you the paperwork on that, okay?
Okay.
And that's the Foreign Agent Act, which everybody needs to definitely file, in the form of 1938, all righty? The attorneys and judges, any case you present and put on anyone, you have to be on file. With the Foreign Agent Act. As a matter of fact, it came out during that hearing in Washington with, with Flinch and Cohen and all them. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, they have no jurisdiction. And if you're not registered, all righty, that means you have zero jurisdiction over anything. It's all false. They couldn't even prosecute a fly. And I also, by the way, I've been going into not only just for my course, people have been asking me to go into the courts rooms for their kids or what have you. And when I guess they all basically, they know of me or whatever when I'm in the courtroom. I bring my notebook and all that. So all of a sudden I said, oh, okay. They're acting somewhat polite, but they're not at ease because I'm sitting there. They don't know who I'm there for. And I noticed what they were doing for even like minority children or whomever. They were giving them not imprisonment this time. They were giving them community service, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was taking all that information and stuff like that. That was for the criminal court.
Well, that's a key point there, too, because, you see, there's criminal warrants and there's also civil warrants. And
right.
Clearly,
and then,
clearly the police cannot exercise a civil warrant.
And then, I doubt,
other than an arrest warrant, well, let me think about this. Any kind of a seizure, with the exception of the person. But if you got to go enter a house, okay, I got to believe it's got to be the sheriff to do that.
Right.
Of course, if you are in the streets and someone recognizes you and there's a warrant out for your arrest, they make the arrest, they bring you down. You know, generally speaking, in my opinion, the best that police are, you know, city police, town police, village police, and maybe even county police, but and I would think county police also, really, their arrests are really the civilian arrest, ultimately. Now, they may have some statutes that give them certain powers or authorities, but again, I don't see them have constitutional powers. I don't see them have constitutional authority.
I got to make a point. It's very important. I'm trying to stay on track because I'm tired. Okay, the point I'm making, all these attorneys, and what I've been doing, I'm telling you, file your grievances on the judges, on the attorneys, you know, because all this is criminal. Ask them for their form, that foreign agent form of 1938, and you could check it out. Make sure you have your juris number, okay? That, like this crazy judge that did reveal on my Social Security, he has been disbarred. He's been disbarred since 2007 as an attorney. He's not even a legal judge, but yet he's signing off. Number one.
You mean the judge has been disbarred?
This other judge has been disbarred on another case I have. So I'm like, I sent all those papers in. All this is criminal, what's been going on. But what I'm saying, so I went into another case, which the people, they asked me to speak. And so I sat in on their trial, and this woman, she's 60, and the state attorneys and these other ones, the city attorney, they and their fathers were judges. They stole all her property. They put her in jail for the next 20 years. So as I sat in the courtroom to listen what they were saying when they were wrapping up the case, because I couldn't sit every day, but the day they were going to sentence her, I went in there. And I took my notes and what they said, and she's been a problem. She's been in and out of jail since the 70s and this and that, da-da-da-da-da-da. So what I did when I spoke in the woman's behalf, I took all their information and used it back on them. So I said, you know, yous are absolutely right. I said, she shouldn't be around seniors or doing private duty. I said, but I am so glad that you brought out a very good point, both sides, both the state attorney and her attorney. I said, you said she's been in and out of the system since the 70s, over 40 years. And you have been involved in dealing with this? Obviously, she's had a mental illness problem all these years. She never should have gone to jail the first day. She should have been on Social Security disability, or she should have been maybe institutionalized. How are you? A mental illness is a sickness. It's not a crime. I said, but yet there's some people you could recognize on a mental illness. And that is criminal when you're throwing a mentally ill person, and that just came out of each and every one of your mouths, that this has been a problem. And you totally disregard, but yet I didn't hear not one of you sit there and say, oh, well, she is mentally ill. So even the judge, everybody was sitting there, and their faces turned as red as a beet. They're all sitting there like, okay. And unfortunately, you know, she got up there when she had to say, you know, she's articulate to a degree. And I said, even through the conversation, I realized that she had some major issues going on. And as I said, her mind would be coming and going through the conversation. You know, I said, she has a good heart, but there was times I said, the system must have beat her down or whatever the case. She turned around and said, well, I'm not mentally ill, and I can, you know, it's like, and so her family was so, everybody was just so upset. They go, she could have walked out, you know? Mm-hmm. And there were certain things I put into place, and even the Foreign Agent Act I put into place. I told the family, give me a call, get her transcript and have this appealed. But you know what? I can't run after people. You understand?
Right.
I got my
right.
own stuff. So that's on them. But
well, let me just ask you one thing, and then
I just want to finish this here, please.
Okay.
The Foreign Agent Act. All righty, and see if they are not unfiled. All righty, they have no jurisdiction. So on these paperwork that I'm going to get over to you, all righty, and these are the documents, you've got to, and I think I did send you the copies of the Foreign Agent Act because they are under the jurisdiction of Great Britain. And if they are not on file, they have no jurisdiction over anyone. It's all illegal.
Is the language pretty clear, or does it list?
Yes, I sent it to you, and I'll send it to you again tomorrow.
All right, well, send me what you got when you get a chance. I'm definitely going to look. I've heard of this before. I've heard people talk about it, but I just never researched it myself.
Well,
so
this sounds very
interesting. I know 1938.
The paperwork I'm going to send you, all amended. Okay, I think I have some other blank ones. And also, that has to be on my paperwork. It's every code and everything. And they had to respond. And whether they did or they didn't, you know. And then that affidavit, because when people are evicted, this is something else I have to share with you, too. What is foreclosure?
Yeah, try to make it a little quick because we've got other people.
Okay, foreclosure on all the people's homes they took. You know what they write on the paperwork? And it was funny when I was sitting there just going through the recordings on some of the other stuff we did with the affidavits. They write abandonment. I said, oh, my God. So I started, all the people that I was, you know, knew that was losing their homes, on all their property and on their deeds and the foreclosure, it says abandonment.
Well, you know, let me address that a minute. You know, that's very interesting. But good. Tell me what you think, and I'd like to address
abandonment.
It.
And so I said, oh, my God. Now, three of the foreclosures, I was there to witness. She said, this wasn't abandonment. They threw the people out. So when they write abandonment, then they go back to the courts. The judge signs off saying they abandoned it, their property, and then they said, I said, no, they were thrown out. And that's why I was telling them, do not leave your property. On the affidavits, I think I did send you, there was a paper I put in all the 8 or 9 points, had it all notarized. I had it recorded on my deed record. I will not leave nor abandon my property. It's all on my land records, okay?
Well, let me address that, because I'll tell you what, when you just said that, a bell went off in my mind here, and, you know, it's the same game that the feds do, the IRS, where they send you a form or a paper, and then you don't respond to that, you know, you acquiesce to that, then they send you another thing and you acquiesce to that, and goes on and on and on, and then they move in, take your property, and it's done. But the people who buck back, push back, and buck them back, and answer everything, and answer every question, and do everything, you know, that it's certified, and make sure that, you know, that you of course you get it. I even go as far as not even just get certified, but also I have someone else make the serving in through the mail, and so I get a certificate service, I think that's exactly what they're doing in the court. Even if you're showing up, if you're not putting paperwork in and you're not really making any claim in the court, you know, per se, and they love to play around with the whatever is said in the court anyway, even though everything's supposed to be recorded, you know. I don't know how they get around with all that. But nevertheless, over a period of time, it's a process, and they make the claim of being abandoned, that you've abandoned the house. I think that's how they're doing it, even though you are physically there and even though you might even show up in the court. But a lot of people also just ignore it until the day they come out and take the property
away.
What
people fail to realize, what is foreclosure? Foreclosure means you abandoned your property.
And it means what?
It means you abandoned your property.
Abandoned,
people,
okay.
Didn't, right, it's abandonment. And I said, oh, my God. And I said, nobody would have picked that up. I said, but that was the work I used to do.
But how did they get the interpretation of the word foreclosure, meaning abandonment?
Because when people abandoned their property, like, for example, and I do remember this because one of the courses I had taken at UConn, when, like, say, for instance, you have a house, and the property next door to you, they are not taking care of it, or nobody comes to trim the yard or whatever the case, it's just sitting there. If you start taking care of that property within 5 years, that property was abandoned. It becomes your property. Then you can put your papers and get the
You know, I wonder if you can apply the squatter's rights here, too.
You're right. You're right.
Well, how many years you got to be there to get squatter's rights?
That's something they just
I don't know if you know that.
Right, but that's something. See, they just threw that in there because.
Yeah, but you see, that's something else that could be done too, possibly. I'd have to think this out a bit, but you know, because
I'll find that out for you. I'm saying because.
But you know, whether you could get away with moving in as also a squatter, as much as also doing the paperwork you've done, and then applying the squatter's rights there too, because after all, the bank abandoned it. They're not.
Right.
They don't have possession of it.
Exactly.
And so you can push that back the other direction.
Three people I know, they put that on their paperwork, too.
I have to look into that. Look, when's
people,
the next time
right.
you go into court?
Excuse me?
When's the next time you go into court, or when's the next time they're claiming to come out to try to take you home?
They didn't say anything because it all happened, but I got all my paperwork. I'm not even under their jurisdiction. Okay.
Look into the marshal. Look into that marshal. Look at two key things here, because you may have hit a nerve here, and you may not even have realized how big a nerve you hit. If they left like that, and did the cop leave first, or did they leave? Or did
they all left. They went running. They went running across the street. The attorney jetted down the street. The cop, they all and we're all sitting there like, what's going on?
I'm interested in trying to figure out how this happened. If someone comes back with coffee. They got five coffees. I guess there's four or five people there. There's a cop there. And then they never get to the point of passing out the coffee, I presume. I don't know, because you say she threw it away. But the thing is, there's signaling by someone. Did someone say something to someone, whether you heard or not, but you see them communicate, and then they took off? Did you see anything?
Well, I saw the attorney got out the car. That's when he put his shades on because he didn't want to be recognized. I told the person, I said, take his picture right now. And he went running beside the police car so he couldn't be seen. Then all of a sudden, they ran so they could be on the camera.
Was the news there? You told the news to take the picture?
A person was there taking I watched on YouTube, but I'll get all that over to you.
Okay.
And then the news came afterwards, yes.
Well, then
they were all gone. They just...
Look, here's what you got to find out. You got to find out if what authority this so-called cop has, okay? If he's a town cop... go look to see the authority, because there are statutes that he operates by. He operates by codes and regulations, and so you look to see what does he have the power, the authority to come to your property and take it away?
No, he probably doesn't.
The thing is you got to make sure, and you should have that in your back pocket, print it out, have it in your back pocket, and say, look.
I'm going to do that tomorrow. No, he does not. I said, like I said.
Okay.
Hold on. This is not a criminal case. This is a civics. This is what I said. I said, where is the sheriff?
It's not really even a civil case. It is a common law case.
Well, a common law civil, but it wasn't a criminal case. It wasn't a police case.
Statutory. Remember that. Okay.
I'm sorry?
The civil is statutory. You know, it's a very fine line, but if you're gonna be you know literal on things, then civil brings you right to statutory process. That's why you know there really is no difference, and there really is no two courts. They have civil courts and they have criminal courts. They seem to have separated, and then neither of those things should be separated. It just should be one court of law and a court of equity, and all cases should be heard. All equity cases could be heard in either equity court or in heard under equity or under law, but all criminal has to be heard under law.
Remember one thing, and you got to remember this.
That's an equity court.
Foreign Agent Act. John, yeah. Number one, the big thing that's going
to
save people.
Foreign Agent Act.
I'm sorry?
I'm going to go pull it down and read the Foreign Agent Act.
The Foreign Agent Act is for everyone. If they are not registered, they have no jurisdiction. And I will get you that tomorrow. I will definitely get out and get those. That is the key. I have the puzzles and this paperwork
I want to, before we end the call with you, I want to just make sure there's another thing you need to think about and look into, and that is Cadet Marshall. You need to understand his powers and authorities, what rules and regulations that he operates under, he or she operates under. Same thing as that town cop, what he or she operates under. What are the rules and regulations? And then when you find through that they don't have certain powers, like coming and taking your property, then that's what you apply. And you want to actually, I would send a certified letter to the police chief or whatever they call the captain or whatever the individual there, letting them know concerning they don't have any rules or regulations guiding them there, and that therefore they have no power or authority. Stay off my property. Thank you very much. But be very nice about it, of course. Now,
as a matter of fact, I have my police report.
Have they brought up Marshall to you?
There is like five or six sheriffs. Okay.
Well, they're marshals, and there's one for every county, and
But we have sheriffs also here in Connecticut. I found out.
You have what?
Sheriffs.
Yeah.
There are some sheriffs. Okay. But most of them are marshals.
Hold on. Listen. Are they appointed? If they're appointed by the governor, you need to go and look and see and make sure that he goes through the same process that any other appointment would go through, as if the president was appointing someone to some, you know, court position, and you need to look up the Constitution to see how that process might work, what information is in there. You need to look up the statutes that control them, that empower them, that give them their, you know, rules and regulations that they operate by. And then when you look at all that stuff, the key thing is you got to find out if there's anything in there that says that the governor has the ability, the power, the authority to remove them from office. If they do, he's not a constitutional officer. Okay?
Okay. But make sure, and like what I did, and all these things I was doing all along, I am so glad. And it's just like, because you know what? I was just doing things by gut feelings. I thank God I filed all my grievances on all these attorneys. And now this last one I filed on, well, now they said we'll do an investigation. Mm-hmm. All the rest of them they tried to dismiss. So right now, every man is for themselves, and I told you, and I think I sent that paperwork to you, too, when Richard Blumenthal...
Yeah, I got a lot of stuff from you, and it's piled up. I haven't been able to go through a lot of it, but
Richard
I did breeze through it, but I'll have to spend time.
That because everybody's been complaining and about the illegal foreclosures, and he said that the Connecticut courts is like a growing cancer, and they're making a ton of money. And this came out the former attorney general, who's our state's or senator down in Washington. So like right now, they're all trying to backpedal. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, look, it's running late, and we've got about four other people in the queue. I'm interested in, you know, you gave me a lot of information. I'm going to take a look at some of this stuff, and I'm looking forward to maybe next week to for more thoughts, and especially what you find in your research. You know, one day when we get into the power and the authority of the courts, we definitely got to do something about Connecticut and their sheriffs. And, we've got five counties here.
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, we got five counties. Let me think. 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. We got 7 counties here in New York that don't have sheriffs. And the sheriffs are appointed by the mayor in the cities. I'm not sure who appoints them in the counties. There's Westchester County doesn't have a sheriff. And then there is also, I think it's, I'm not sure whether it's Suffolk or NASA. I think it's NASA that doesn't have a sheriff. Out there in Long Island. But anyway, let me move on because...
This is the last thing. Everybody in every state needs to find out how many attorneys you have in each city. Our state got over 33,000. We're the third smallest state in the United States. They're all on the payroll. And they're the ones who are getting everybody's property and land.
Right.
Okay. But there's some
other... Yeah, the whole system.
Understand. Okay, but I don't want to take up no more of your time, but there's other stuff
that makes a serious problem there, because you're right. They monetize these all of these what they call mortgages, and they steal the properties from people, then they remortgage them out, then they sell the mortgages, they put them into trust.
And that's called MERS. It's a Ponzi scheme. And that's why Shelton Silver, your attorney up your way, he's the one who started this.
And then the attorneys buy them for their retirements.
Oh, absolutely. But there's other stuff, you know. But as I said, I know you got other calls. But that's, people need to get that foreign agent, find out how many attorneys and judges are, and half of them, they, you know what, they all got fake degrees, because here I don't have any degrees, and I've been representing myself for the past 6 years, and I've been whooping their tails through the, you know, NLA. Learning and
well, let's hope
people.
You can stay ahead of them, and you got to be making your moves now, because they're going to make their next plan, because they're evil and they don't want to let you go, because that's how evil they are, you know.
Well,
so
I have God in Jesus Christ.
Well, that's
you know?
True. Amen to that. But
you
remember,
know,
you got to still do your homework. Be as what is it? Wise as serpents and gentle as lambs. Is that how that one goes?
Yeah,
I forget how.
The good thing, I think, Jehovah God and Jesus Christ, all my papers are on file and recorded on my land records. Like I said a few years ago, who's going to change these legal documents? And
yeah, this is what you got to get to. You got to get ahead of them. And if they have, I am so surprised that they didn't go out to get the marshal. Maybe they can't get the marshal to do this work. But and the other thing is Connecticut a non-foreclosure state? That's another question you got to find out. And
but
because like New York
John,
is not
John, yeah? If you know what the warranty deed is, John.
Well, not the way. No, I don't. Not particularly.
The warranty deed is that if I want to put Mr. Magoo on my property or anybody on there, it's my sole property. You can't change deed records.
Yes, I understand that, but here's the problem. They don't want to hear it. And if they think they can get away with it, they'll bulldoze their way in and just do what they want and take your property.
That's where that Foreign Agent Act will be in touch.
I'm trying to tell you another step that you need to get. You need to invest this marshal. Okay? Then if you discover what you got to discover, to see what powers and what authorities. I'm scratching on my head on why they didn't call the marshal. Do you know one way or the other? Has Connecticut declared themselves a non-judicial foreclosure state? New York State is not a non-judicial foreclosure state, yet they do non-judicial foreclosures all day long here. And they do it in a lot of states that don't have it written in their laws. So if they're not written up as a non-judicial foreclosure, again, more weapon that you have. And then if you think it's necessary, and you got to play this by ear, to make some communications with the marshal, to get him on your side, to educate him, to show them what they're doing to you, and lay this out for them. They may already know some of this stuff. And then you get the agreement with them, well, look, if these people come out here with these cops again, can I call you? Where is your authority? You see, but you need to know
they
the
are not. They're not. They're all in the pocket. They're all in the pocket together. So that's just tough. Like wasting your breath on that, you know.
Let me move on because it's getting late.
Okay, I will speak to you later.
I'd like to hear some more maybe next week.
Okay, you have a good night.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to Constance, is it, in Connecticut?
Hi, this is Connie from Connecticut. I have a few questions, and it has to do with friends of mine who are targeted individuals. And anyways, they will go to the police and complain their devices are getting hacked or that their items are being stolen on their property and their home is being vandalized. And what's happening to these people is the police are they'll hold them like at the jail, keep them talking, and all of a sudden medical professionals come out of the back room, and then the police says, well, I think you have psychological
mental illness. Yep.
What?
And isn't that interesting? They got to arrest you to have you evaluated for mental issues. That's a game they play. I've seen it played a number of times. I see them threatening people with that all the time. I know someone who went to jail 8 months. They were in, Rikers Island down in New York City, probably one of the worst county jails anyone can go to. And 8 months down there, injected with drugs and being evaluated for 8 months to try to make a claim that they were mentally unbalanced. And it's a game they play. It's a very dangerous game, and it's got to stop. And I'll tell you what, only an educated sheriff's going to really protect you from that one.
Okay, so the my friends who it happened to in the last 2 months, they get forced. They say, if you don't come with us voluntarily, we'll take you by force. So all of them went voluntarily. Then they basically have to talk and try to get out of the hospital and say, I'm of sound mind and body and was forced to come here. They try to get them to sign. So I tell them, don't sign anything because that's going to mean you're there involuntarily and it's going to be harder to bill. But anyways, they end up getting bills from these mental health assessors that are with the cops and the hospital and everything else. The ones that got out the same day or night, they didn't have insurance. So I think this all plays into why everybody has to have insurance or you have a tax bill. And also people, you know, in Obamacare.
Well, that's interesting. You definitely don't want to let a court know that you have insurance.
Yeah. So, and several of these people had, and what they do is they confiscate their phone and their belongings and all that stuff. So,
they're just evil.
Well,
they're so evil.
$265 was stolen from his wallet in the 3 or 4 hours that he was at the hospital. They let him go when they realized he had no insurance. And when he tried to file a police report about stolen money, they wouldn't file a police report. So isn't there anything...
You're in Connecticut too, aren't you? Oh, no.
And I was on the phone with one of them they kept on telling her to hang up the phone. She said, no, I'm talking to my advocate. And they asked for my name, and I gave them my full name and where I live. And I said, you're trespassing, and she does not permit you to be there. And I told her, tell them. She was so nervous. She told them once really quick in the beginning, but she should have repeated it over and over again that they were trespassing and they had no right to be, you know, on her property. But she got out because she threatened to sue the hospital and the psychiatrist, and she called a lawyer.
Well, look, there's only one thing that I can think of that people can do when they get stuck in this situation, but they shouldn't dig deep enough into the court case and play the game back and forth that long that you'll end up under that kind of a threat. But if you do and you're there, is one thing you could do, the only thing you could do that I could think of is move it into federal court for cause. Look, they're trying to imprison you without due process. They're trying to, first of all, they're not giving you due process in the issue to begin with. all these issues, it's not, you're not getting due process. So, but again, how do you get into federal court is the key. People have to learn how to do that. And by the way, you know, the book that that's going to be written while this course is being written, the book is being written, and there'll be more things in the book than in the course. And one of the things it'll cover is that kind of a thing, you know, how to move a case into a federal court. You know, the documents that you need to move a case, you know, there are forms, there are procedures that you run through. And, you know, a form is a form. It doesn't have to be followed. You don't have to take that form and run through it, you know, but it just gives you the information that's required on that that instrument that's required to go forward, to move it forward in from whatever it is that you're doing. But to move a case into the federal court is very simple, but people get lost in they confuse the nuts and bolts of the case with the constitutional issue, you know, and then the federal court throws you out because they have no power to make any rulings on any of these things. The only ruling they can make they have the power or the authority to do is on the constitutional issue. So you got to make it a constitutional issue. And if you can convince the federal court that A, you got a constitutional issue, B, that you're right, and they're not giving you due process, the end results of the wherefore clause in that, which is very simple, you know, 3-4 pages at most, and then you get your wherefore clause, which is cease and desist and don't bother me ever again, and the federal order goes down to the court, let this person go. And that's the power of moving it into a federal court for a constitutional cause. Now, the federal courts, they love to see that you have to, they want to get you to write some kind of a USC in there, usually under USC 18 or USC 42, which you can do. I mean, that's okay to do that. One's criminal and the other one is civil, and you should do both. And it's okay, but you can't, you don't want to move it into federal court for that cause, and you want to make it clear that because you're exercising, you know, by you know, naming and putting into your paperwork these U.S. codes, you're doing it because they're under these authorities, not you. You're not under it. But you got to be careful on how you say that, too. So it is kind of tricky, and I don't know many people that understand how to really do it, and most people, the courts refuse to hear the case.
But let me ask you something. I told the officer, you're supposed to serve and protect the public. And so these people who are reporting theft, vandalism, electronic hacking, you know, they're being punished, and this is a tactic going on across the United States. And so now these people are reluctant to ask the police for help. So, like, unless it's like life or death situation, right, they're not going to ask them for help.
Well, so, look, here's the bottom line. Here's the bottom line to all of these problems. We need to take our courts back. And it starts with the federal court. That's why we're going after the federal court to bring back courts of record again, because they have what they claim is a court of record is not a court of record at all. And so once we can get that and get into the courts to bring the administrations, the people as the administrators for the jury so that they're no longer, you know, brought under the control of the prosecutor or control of the judge to get their conviction, once we could empower the people to do that and they do that, then it's a no-brainer at that point. It moves right on down the system. You take over the state courts and the federal courts will back you up on that because they have no choice. And you can shut down the town courts if you're not participating, you want to participate. All those other courts can be shut down, and a whole new process, which is deserved, needs to be put back in place, which brings us back. We, the people, are under the law of God. We're not under positive law. Positive law is legislative law. We are not under that, need that. If we are under legislative law, if we're under positive law, then we are under the thumb of the government. We are subject to them. But the truth of the matter is, and people don't realize this, is that they are subject to us. The Constitution makes it absolutely clear. We, the people, ordained and established. The Declaration of Independence makes it clear. We have the power and the authority to shut down government. We have the power and authority to change government, to change the guard. We have that power and authority. And these are unalienable rights. That is that which is given to us by God, okay? Not from men. You cannot sell it. You can't take it away. And any man who tries to violate that, they have to face the wrath of God. And so if you're one of God's children, you know, last thing they want to do is really, come in and assault you, because at some point they're going to have to pay for that. But, you know, this is where the battle is, and this is what we're trying to do here at National Liberty Alliance. Then we got to change minds and hearts. We have to require our sheriffs to know the Constitution, okay? And not just any place. Look, I have looked at constitutional courses. I've looked at common law courses. I've looked at a lot of different things, and they really don't get down to the brass tacks. I mean, they don't get down to the details. They don't tie it into common law. They don't take it into the Federalist Papers. They don't take it into the conclusions of the United States Supreme Court with some very powerful, opinions that have come out over the last couple of hundred years. They don't take it to those places. But we do. That's where we take it to, because that's power. That's authority. They don't take it to the Bible. We do. So in our course, we cover all that, and in the book, we're covering all that. And so, therefore, all of these sheriffs, they need to either take this course that we have or one equivalent to that, and I don't know that they can find one, get the book and read the book and then start exercising the law, because they don't know it. And you would think that a constitutional officer, such as a sheriff, would be very interested in this. I have spoken to sheriffs, and on two occasions, sheriffs have said, "I don't know." They don't know. They have to go to the county attorney to talk to them to interpret the Constitution. Well, what the hell did you pick your hand up and swear an oath to something that you couldn't uphold? You know, and they look at you like you got six heads. They don't have an answer for that one. But you see, that's the problem. First of all, they got to recognize that they don't understand the Constitution, and that they have to rely on another man, and that they've committed an act of subversion, really, by swearing to something that they couldn't even do, okay? And then they're not doing it. They're not upholding the Constitution. They're not protecting the Constitution. They're not holding it up, supporting it. So it's up to we, the people, to teach them, you know? And again, once we get this course completed, as a matter of fact, right now, everybody should be pushing their sheriff to get out here and take the course. We'll talk about that next week, maybe, because we do have a page for sheriffs that they come in on, and we can tie them into our course right here on National Liberty Alliance's pages, where they can come in and take the course. Every sheriff and every deputy needs to take a constitutional course, but it has to be a serious one, not one that just pussyfoots around the issues and never gives real true knowledge. Just keeps them into ignorance.
And the other thing, since this call is recorded, so some of these people that I've helped get out of psych wards and stuff, you know, one gentleman has a multi-million dollar lawsuit, and that's what this is going to do. It's going to bankrupt counties and towns, because these people are going to sue, and by the time they're done with them, then, yeah, the feds are probably going to have to step in, because these counties and towns...
Yeah, but they're never going to get through the courts. I know if they come in pro se, they'll definitely be thrown out on Rule 12. That's their common MO on this. The other thing is, if they come in with a lawyer, the lawyer will be taken into the back room. It'll be explained to, this is how it's going to end. And they don't really have to talk to them much about this stuff, because they already know. They have to play the game. You know, they signal back and forth. They have their little meetings. The judge lays out certain rules. You know, he may not explain it, because it'd be stupid to explain it all. But they understand how it's going to end up. And generally speaking, the lawyers, if they go up and buck up against the judge, then they're running into another problem. They could lose their license. They could be sanctioned. They could be held in contempt. They control them. And then, of course, they control us by kicking us out. So until we take back the courts, we're not going to get anywhere. Now, we've already done a quo warranto on the federal government and all three branches.
Some of these people are going to go pro se, and they have great evidence, because on one of the police officers, He works for the police department, and he sues them, and he says the captain has stuff on all his officers, and he uses it against them, so as a form of intimidation, and that's a case. So, you know, and the town has been sued because of the police. Yeah, a lot of these people don't trust lawyers and won't go that route because they
know. It's tough. But, again, we've already done a quo warranto, and we've done it on the federal government, all three branches, and they defaulted on that. They never responded. Of course, we can't really do anything now, but that's a serious thing. The fact that they didn't respond to quo warranto, because that has the power and authority of bankrupting the whole system, taking everything. Now, I'm trying to remember what the name of these accounts are called. You know, there's the SESCU accounts that they have for each individual, but there's other accounts that they really funnel a lot of money into. The courts follow, the local courts funnel money into it, or all of these different agencies, and then they expand their retirement funds into it. But I can't think of the name of it. But these towns and counties and cities and collectively, they have huge amounts of money, mostly in real estate and different things that are tied up in this thing. And that's where you can get the money. The money is available there. But the thing is you'll not move the courts, at least the way they are today, to do the right thing. It's not going to happen, you know. So, all right, let me move on because we only have a few minutes left and we have a couple more people, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Tommy. Okay, we only got a few minutes, so let's say 5 minutes or so for each one. We got three people left, so if we do 5 minutes apiece, we can get everybody in. And we'll be back next Monday also. But let's take Daniel from Utah.
Hi there. Thank you, John and Brent, very much for your words and your service to the common law. I have a comment on the bankruptcies. I don't remember the details of the Bible talking about that. I remember reading something about it. I just don't remember the details about the seven-year stuff. But I do remember the 50-year jubilee, whatever.
That's two different things, by the way. I'll let Brent here, and maybe he can respond because he did bring up the bankruptcy a little earlier.
He was
talking about how the federal law is set up for the bankruptcies, I think, is what he was talking about. As far as the Bible is concerned, he may know more about that than I do as far as on that subject, but go ahead.
Okay, I'm not too concerned about those details. I'm just kind of given a reference point, but as far as the bankruptcy,
something different though.
If I may, as far as the bankruptcy law goes, I think it's mostly just organized crime because within our economic system, people are allowed to take their wealth and put it into fictional organizations so that if any worker or investor wants to claim the right to their investment, it's basically legally stolen through fictional entities such as corrupt trusts and corporations. And so the laws we have today do not apply biblically. It's organized robbery and theft.
Well, that's a good point, and I do understand to some degree how the structures go with corporations and how you can, for instance, you know, if you have a business going, let's say you're an excavator, and you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars in machinery, you know, one machine can cost you $100,000-$200,000. You know, you get these big excavators or these big D9s, dozers, and different things. It makes sense to say, well, let me create a corporation that would take ownership and be a rental company to another company I have to rent the machinery to go out to do a construction job and get a contract, which is under a different corporation. So you have two different entities, and I can understand the logic of doing that, the structure of protecting yourself and so on and so forth. The legality of it, if there is one under common law, which I believe there would be, because the right to create a a corporation, I think, I'm not sure how that all that worked. Brent, do you have any knowledge in this? If he's still here, I don't know if Brent is still here.
I'm here, John. I had done.
Do you have any knowledge on this, on what is the really the right thing with these corporations and stuff?
In other words, can they take bankruptcy? I didn't get the question.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing that I'm getting to. Let's put it this way. Under common law, are corporations lawful entities or they only exist within the statutory laws? And in those, I'm not sure that I've seen anything.
Oh, I see your point. They only exist in statutory laws. They didn't arise in visibility in the West until the 11th century, and the Roman Church was behind them. That's how they all started, and that's where they started. And I take my authority on that from Harold Berryman's book, Law and Revolution. It's a well-known book. It goes into great detail talking about that. But corporations are fictions, and the law of the city, the civil law, is all about fictions. It's all about the man that has the power to decree or legislate or say he can make law and call what is, what isn't. As the Bible says of God, he's the only one who has the power to call what is not, and what is not, what is. That's the prerogative of the creator. But a corporation is the attempt of men by power of state government to do that. That's been my conviction over the years. It's taken me a while to get here to say, no, corporations are fundamentally evil because they allow people to hide behind a fake person and do evil things, and that's what they end up doing. And people say, but we need the limited liability. We can get the limited liability using the trust. The trust is not an entity. It's not a corporation. It's not formed by government. It's not a creature of the state, and the trust offers limited liability even more so. And that's why they're so popular, for example, in the Canadian stock market. Back in the 90s, 60% of all the investment organizations on the Canadian stock market were the trust. And all the mutual funds have always been trust. They've not been corporations. So the corporation is not really needed. The only reason the corporation has become popular is because it allows the government to put a brass ring in the nose of the corporation and control the people that are included in it. And that's what that amounts to, and especially, of course, as we've talked about before, for churches. Churches that incorporate are turning themselves over, lock, stock, and barrel, to the government.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Right. We were talking about that in the beginning. Yeah, those. I think they're called 401(c)(3). What was that, Jan? 401(c)(3).
501.
501. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Whatever. They're all numbers anyway. But, yeah, it's nothing but evil. So. All right. Does the Bible say, concerning that, Brent? Do you know if the Bible has a position for or against these fictional entities, or that it's not even mentioned?
Well, in this sense, the Book of Ephesians, one of the themes of it is the body. That's what corpus means. Corporation is Latin for embodiment. Corporation means embodiment. Corpus means body. Corpse means dead body. It's all the same root. That's what a corporation is. It's a corpse. It's a dead body that the government says they've breathed life into. But the Book of Ephesians in the New Testament is the theme of it is the body, the incorporation of the body of Jesus Christ. That's what it's all about. And so it does mention it in that sense. But to take if the church, and that's what the theme of the God's people, if the congregation of God's people is the body of Jesus Christ by analogy, and that's what it's called, then why would you want to take a creature of government and wrap it, a corporation, around that body? That's the evil of church and corporation. But
we do create the trust, and that's interesting you brought that up, because then in God we trust, so our trust belongs to him.
Yes,
he's the beneficiary, go sue him.
Yes, no, that's right. And the trust is not what's that?
I know, it is right. It makes all the sense in the world. I mean,
it
I didn't realize that
together.
Before until just now.
Yeah, but it all fits together. The more a fellow looks at it, the more true law, in my experience, is a seamless cloth. It's all woven together. It's all connected, and one thing leads to another, and you begin to see, and you get lost in the details. You can never plumb the depth of how true law fits together, but you can contemplate it, and you begin to see the wisdom of it. But yeah, I've come to that conclusion, John, about corporations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me say, we talked a little bit about this earlier at the beginning of the program, and therein is the solution for that person who brought up the question about coming into a, you know, these particular corporations that the government wants these churches to go into. And The solution is to create a trust and make Jesus Christ the beneficiary. You get a lot of biblical principles to lay that out, and then go preach the gospel. And if they want to go after anybody, let them go after Jesus Christ. Period.
That's not funny. That just tickles me the way you
do that.
It is funny. Yeah, it is funny.
You must do somebody's
It's good. It's good though.
Yeah.
It's good and funny. Yeah.
There's the answer. That's what I would do if I was.
I have another comment about the.
I would
the currency.
We'll try to do this one quick because we do have two more people. But go ahead.
Okay, if I can be allowed to do some speaking. The comment on the Congress regulating the value of currency, I think that's bad language that's consistent with the Congress regulating commerce. It all supports monopolyism as well as bankruptcy does.
Well, they don't have the power to regulate currency. They have the power to
Well, it says regulate the value thereof, and I'm saying that is
they should assign
a value.
That's the way.
I just think I know what it is. I think it's just corrupt wording. I think it should say they assign a value, not regulate, because regulate is not based on rule of law. It should say assign a value. The law on supply and demand should regulate, not Congress. And same with the so-called commerce, which is I think a corrupt word, but. Congress should not have any control of what goes on between the states other than to make sure the states are not violating the common law rights of the people. And that's another form of monopolyism where the corporations join with Congress to monopolize the economy and the currency. And I think it's all organized crime. And I think there were purposely flaws put in the original contract to allow the bankers to come in and take over. And I think the control of commerce and the currency are some of those major rules or laws which actually violate common law, from my point of view.
Once we put all of these bankers in jail and close down all of these, close down the Fed, which is going to happen not long from now, I mean, you could see where Trump is going with this stuff, and if you see some of his pictures, he's got Jackson hanging on the wall right where he works, so you know where his head is at. I know Judge Napolitano commented on some of this stuff, particularly on the meaning of the word regulate, for Congress to have the power and the authority to regulate. And he makes the point that if you go back into our founding fathers, look into the Federalist and, you know, how they interpret it, because all you got to do is read that stuff. The idea of regulate is to make regular, ultimately, not to regulate like the spigot turn full blast here and half blast there. You know, that's not the regulation that's being meant there. That being the case, I would take that word and do the same thing with regulating the weights and measures, which I think is really talking ultimately in the case of regulating the value of, I guess, the gold and the silver. Like, we know that if you go back into pre-Fed time, an ounce of gold was, let me think what it was, I think it was $18.94. So that was the number given to the ounce of, let me go back, an ounce of silver. Let me think about this.
It should have said regulate the content thereof instead of the value, because has to be determined by.
It was regulated and held for 100 years. It only moved back and forth a penny in a 100-year period. I mean, if you were alive before the Fed, came into power and being. Then what you would pay for a loaf of bread or a container of milk would be the same thing that George Washington and any of our founding fathers might have paid for it. So that was the value of something, and nothing changed then. There was no inflation because, you know, they were to use the gold and the silver, the coins. Now, you know, I'm sure they used other things, bartering and everything, especially way back, you know, for that first 100 years. But there was money, there was coins, there was gold, and there was silver. Of course, they removed all that, and the whole thing has gone a different direction. you know?
I see your point, but what do you think about the commerce, them regulating commerce between the states, and then they kind of use that to...
regular, not to control it by turning the faucet high or low. That's the problem, because, yeah, they do that with insurance companies. I know they do it with, I know when I was with Prepaid Legal, they did it with them. I know when I was with Ameriplan, they did it with them. It operated this way in this state and that way in that state. They were allowed to do certain things in this state and allowed to do certain things in that state. That's not making things regular. That's controlling. And that's why the game is they change the meaning of words. If you go back to the original meanings of these words, where do you get that? Go to the Federalist Papers. You'll find your answers, a lot of your answers there, or it'll stem out from there in conversations between our founding fathers in their papers, you know, letters to each other. You'll find the answers to all of these situations. And I believe Judge Napolitano had the right point to make it regular is what our founding fathers meant, not to regulate and control, you know, to flow here and not flow there.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but the word regulate or regular can be applied to different many different levels. If it said regulate by rule of law, then that would have taken away the power to corrupt it. But
look, that's construction of law right there. Is construction of law. You go back and you look at the whole picture, you get all the information, and then you look at the construction of the law, and one thing builds upon another, and then you see exactly what they're talking about. It works the same way if you go back into the Federalist Papers. Go find out what our founding fathers, the debate that our founding fathers had about coining money. Find out what their debate and their arguments were. You know, you can find this in the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalists.
I'm familiar with most of that, but I just the language used allows for corruption. Where if they simplified the language, it wouldn't give that wiggle room for corruption.
But again, if our founding fathers interpreted it a certain way, then we should interpret it the same way. And Jefferson said exactly that. Go back to the where the debates were. Find the very meanings within the debates and exercise the meanings from those arguments there to the meanings of the understanding of law now.
And you make a good point about original meaning, but I think another thing would be good is when you have a constitution written, you should actually have a constitutional dictionary that defines every word in there for every member of the nation to understand clearly.
Look, you know, I'm putting together the study right now, and I'm working on the Constitution right now. I just finished on the Declaration of Independence. I'm taking a very different approach than anyone else that I'm aware of has taken on how to look at this. And you'll see that it interprets itself under construction of law. You know, if you're going to look at the Senate, let's look at the entire Constitution and see what applies to the Senate. Let's see what their powers are, what their authorities are. You'll find some information under Article 2, which is about the administration, but it'll talk about some powers of the Senate in there. The same thing with Congress. Or you look into Article 5, where it talks about the right of suffrage of the states, which is the right to vote. Which makes them, you know, that right to vote gives them a say, makes them sovereign. You take away that right, you took away their sovereignty. They have no say. You're subject now to that which is empowered over you. So, but the thing is that if you take the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights, those three documents. I mean, you can apply maybe even if you want to, you can apply the Magna Carta to this if you want. And it'll still work, and definitely you can apply the Bible to this. But just those three documents, work those three documents, understand three things. Number one, the Declaration of Independence is the foundation of our law. That's the foundation. That's the covenant with God. That's where we received our unalienable rights. That's when we turned to God. God covenanted with us, and no man can break it, okay? We can never lose it. And men need to understand that because then they can fight for it if they understand it. The second thing is the law. And the law is the law of the government, which is the Constitution. We're a republic. But our republic and our Constitution that makes us a republic is different than any other Constitution. Number one, it puts us under law and equity. It makes God part of the process under natural law that we've received our powers and authorities from God under common law. And again, that's where our foundation, the Declaration of Independence, is. But these statements are also made in the Constitution. And then we've given the powers to the three branches of government, the two houses, the judiciary, and the administrative, very clearly laid out. Any power that they think they have, if it's not in there, they don't have it. Then if they want to abuse those powers and, you know, do things to hurt us with it, now you have the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is the capstone of the Constitution, because everything is understood in light of that capstone, in light of our unalienable rights, those 10 amendments. And so anything that violates that government can do, and even if they have a certain power, but they extend it beyond what really they can take it, because now they're violating your rights in something, well, it gets squashed by the Bill of Rights. That's why the Bill of Rights is the most, in my opinion, the most simplest document out there, but also the most deepest, the most informed, the most power, the most authoritative, the most controlling of all the documents, of all the other two documents. The Bill of Rights solves all the problems. It was a masterpiece of work, a masterpiece, in my opinion. You know, people say, we got to go back to the Constitution of 1987. Well, the Constitution of 1987 that was agreed upon in 1987, and some of the states wouldn't sign on because they were concerned, the Bill of Rights solved those problems, so the agreement was made that a Bill of Rights would be added at a later time, which it stated it does, okay, in 1989. I meant 1787 and 1789. 1789, they signed off to the Constitution awaiting the Bill of Rights. I think it was 3 years later in 92. But the thing is, the people who are talking about a Constitution in 1787, they don't understand that's a Constitution without a Bill of Rights. The Constitution of 1787 to 1789 did not change. The one that was effective, brought into effect in 89, was the one that was concluded in 87. But again, they had to get the signatures, and some states wouldn't sign. And so
common law is very critical to our Constitution.
Here's what I'm trying to say, and this is a very important point, because it makes my point about what I said earlier tonight and what I've said many times before. And that is, you know, I've been to all these websites. I see what they're writing, and they don't half the time know what they're talking about. They're missing a lot of points. They're taking things to exaggeration. They're taking things that they really haven't got a complete construction of law yet on it, and they're telling you to do silly things that are going to get you in trouble. And at the same time, they claim, you'll hear this, it's riddled throughout all of these websites, we should go back to the 1787 Constitution, the first one that was written. Well, that's no different than the 1789. The only difference in the 1789 was that they agreed that they were going to put a Bill of Rights in. And then it was inserted 3 years later. I think it was 3 years later.
Yeah, just a little ignorance on their part there. Yeah.
So, you know, that tells you, if they don't do their homework there to understand that, and you get that by reading the Federalist Papers, by reading the Anti-Federalist Papers also, and by reading some of the communications between our founding fathers at the time, okay? When you look at that stuff, now you start to understand, but they missed that. So if they missed that, what else did they miss, you know? I never should have went to the county to file my standing and put in a paper a declaration concerning I did that, you know? Because I was following their things. You know, they knew more than I did. I didn't know anything at the time. And but then when you research and start looking at things, a lot of problems. They haven't really worked it all the way through. They're right on a lot of things. Don't get me wrong on that. But how to deal with it is where they're 100% wrong, you know. But anyway.
Does it help to record it with the county, or are you better to do it with the
You don't need to do anything there. When you go into court, if you have to go to a court, I'm one of the people. You've said it all.
People. That makes sense.
We the people ordained and established this Constitution for you. I've already told them everything they need to know about my standing. They'll never challenge my standing because they can't win the battle. That's why they do Rule 12 on you, throw you out.
Well, that's what I did with them, so that should handle it, as long as they're on notice and...
All right, well, let me move on. If you have more,
John.
I know, I just wanted to try to finish up. Let me just get real quick. I'll give Fred a minute or two and Valerie Thank you, Daniel. Fred, you got the mic for a minute or two. We've got to make it quick, sorry.
Give Valerie the shot. I'll come in next week.
Okay,
really
we'll talk to you.
Thanks anyway, John.
No problem. Appreciate the call. Okay, Valerie, you got a couple of minutes? What do you got?
I just wanted to ask if you're aware of that lawsuit, the grand jury for 9/11 from the architects and engineers, and if you had any information on that.
Well, we're aware of the websites and the information. I think we have some documents from those people. You know, if we could get the volunteers to work with us for making contact with organizations like that, we'd like to act as grand jury to hear their case and bring it before. We did bring their paperwork together. We did do something on a an indictment, as a matter of fact, I believe. Did we do an, maybe we didn't do the indictment on 9/11 yet, but we do have all the paperwork up there, and we do have all the research paper from the engineers if you wanted to go read it up on our website. But are you saying there's a grand jury has already done an indictment on this?
I'm sure,
to be honest with you.
What?
With Trump, with the 76,000 or whatever indictments that have come together during the past year under Trump's administration, is probably indictments because they're going after, you know, if you listen to David Zublik channel that was put out today on the 21st, he lays out all of the big people that have been indicted and what they were indicted for, and Bush was brought up on that concerning the 9/11 issue. And there are other people.
Yeah, I actually am friends on Facebook with him, but we don't really talk. But I don't know why we're friends. We don't even talk. But I can message him, but he doesn't answer. And I have listened to him. Yeah, I've listened to that video.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not aware of any other group that has done an indictment on the 9/11.
Well, there's a grand jury meeting on it now, John. We're about to.
Now, who pulled the grand jury together? We know.
Well, the whole group of attorneys and engineers and so on got together and submitted it, and a grand jury was formed, and they raised $50,000 amongst themselves to monitor it and keep an eye on it.
Well, we did put together, and we haven't gone through it yet, but we have the grand jury criminal investigating the evidence, regarding the 9/11 conspiracy. You can find that on our website, and we have the 9/11 investigation report by the engineers up there, and we have other things. I think we have some videos up here and other documents. Who is really behind the 9/11 attacks, which gets involved into the naming of the people. We have not only names, the connections and the motives, and other information. So if anybody wants to look at that information, you go up to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, blue bar, far right side, highlight the grand jury. When you highlight the grand jury, you come down and you click on grand jury investigations. And the first... issue, which is the grand jury criminal investigation evidence regarding the 9/11 conspiracy, is right up on top. We also have grand jury criminal investigation evidence regarding the IRS, and we also have grand jury criminal investigation evidence regarding the nonjudicial foreclosures. We did agree as a grand jury for indictments of judges and other officers who get involved in the non-judicial foreclosures to do a any of them that are disobedient. Once we reveal to them the crime in what they're doing, then an indictment is called for those judges and any other officer involved. So, but anyway, we're investigating that too, but. Whoever gets it and gets it done and accomplished, that's the key. I think a lot of this is already done, because if you listen, you heard the Zublik thing today, Jan? Did you listen to
that? I heard one that sounds like it. That came out a week ago, though.
Oh, no. The one that came out today got the very deep details.
Yeah, well, okay. It's always the other one. It had names and everything.
Yeah, I heard that one too, but this is more focused and accurate and more conclusive. But in any event, it appears that indictments have been done on people in 9/11, and Bush is one of them.
Also, I wanted to say that last week when you were asking for volunteers, I don't know if you got my email back, but I was trying to respond. The first time it never went through, I don't know why, but then I tried again, and I hope you got it. But, yeah, I will be willing to make phone calls, just send whatever information you want. Just either call me. I gave you my
Jen,
number.
Jen, did you get that from Valerie? Jen, did you get that message?
I'll have to check the master list to see if she's on it.
Okay. You can pull a phone number and name here also on the board.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Okay. Yeah.
That's channel.
Okay. And also, I just wanted to add that Andrew Zeburn, he passed his civics test, and I don't know if he's interested in becoming a grand jury
Anybody who wants to become a grand jury administrator, I believe when you join, you're asked if you want to do that, and you can check the box. But if you don't, when you go to take the course, I believe there's a box there you could check to take it. And even if you don't do it there, I believe you should be able to go into your account and click a box. Do you know if we set that up where people can go click a box on that, Jen?
Yes. That was taken care of. And Valerie is on the list, so that means that Gary and Ron or Ron will be contacting her.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, they have a problem trying to figure out or find out how to, check the box so that they get onto the list as an administrator. You know what? They could bring it up next Monday. And between now and then, Jan, maybe we can find out exactly where that's at so we can direct people. And it should be an option.
Grand jury administrator, isn't it?
Well, I'm looking at grand jury. Okay, here it is. Let's see. Become a grand jury administrator. Okay, let me click on that. I don't know whether we put a box in here where they can click on and send free... blah, 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 blah. I say, to become a grand jury administrator, if you are not already one, click here. Okay, let me click there. To remove yourself, if you already are one, you can click there. Okay, click submit to become a grand jury administrator. Okay, right there it is. It's very simple.
Yep, right.
So under the grand jury tab, you come down to become a grand jury administrator right on the bottom. And then click the button. Click here. That's it.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if he's interested or not, but he certainly could, right? If he mm-hmm. passed the civics.
Well, course. Anybody who wants to become a grand jury administrator needs to be doing two things: go down and click the button. They should be taking the civics course, and they should be taking government by consent course. Those two courses are absolutely the bare minimum requirement to become an administrator. There's plenty of knowledge between those two courses for everything you need to know or think. Now, we're going to do a handbook on that for forms, you know, how to write an indictment, how to write a rejection of indicting, how to write informations, you know, instructional things. We're also going to lay out a plan for orientation for people when they become jurists, whether it's grand jury or trial jury. They'll go through an orientation program, maybe about 6 hours, do it in one day, you know, to orientate them and prepare them for the job that they're going to be going into, which will best be the basics understanding of their power and authority and the power of the Constitution. And just put a very simple, we're going to put a very simple thing together. It'll probably be a series of videos, or watch a video for 20 minutes or a half hour, then a conversation, and then a couple of basic points to make sure that they got, and then another video and so on. So it'll be very simple, and it should be an enjoyable 6 hours, you know, for the process. But as far as the administrators themselves, they need somewhat of an education. You can't just go become an administrator and just have no knowledge of the Constitution yourself, no knowledge of what law is, the power and authority of Congress to make law, the U.S. titles, how many titles there are, and that they are. They do have authority. 27 of them are positive law. The rest are administrative processes, which really gets you down to regulations and operations of the different agencies. It's nothing more serious, more deeper than that. You know, it's pretty simple stuff, and they don't need to know it. You know, the detail, the specifics inside of it. They just need to understand the authority of it and that it's legitimate. But they also need to know the flaws of the penal law written in it. Don't belong there. Of the civil courts written up that we don't belong in. We belong in courts of law. Or an equity court if we choose to do so that operates under American jurisprudence. And they need to understand what that means. Anyway, that's pretty much it. So, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Valerie. Yes. And sorry we went too late. Have a good night. Okay,
all
good
right,
night,
bye.
Everyone. Bye. Good night, everyone. Thanks for coming. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday, and we'll see where we go from there. Thank you. Good night.